You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
That's better. Good morning. I'm not sure you want to hear me, but you'd have no choice at this point. I'm Richard Bush. I'm the director of the Center for East Asia Policy Studies here at Brookings. And it's our great privilege today to co-sponsor with the Institute of Political Science at Academia Sinica in the Republic of China and the Center for East Asian Democratic Studies at National Taiwan University a program on competition over soft power in East Asia. There's a lot of talk these days about the future of the East Asian order and the changing balance of power and what it means. Most of this talk takes place in foreign ministries, defense ministries, think tanks, other places like that. It's by elites, for elites, and of elites. And very rarely does anybody ask the people of the countries concerned what they think. Fortunately, there are a couple of organizations that do that. One is the Pew Research Center, and which is represented here today by my good friend Bruce Stokes. The other is the Asian Barometer Survey, which does a lot of good work on the state of democracy in East Asia, but has also focused more and more on how East Asians view the rise of China and what it means for the United States. So Asian Barometer Survey has just completed their last wave of surveying in 14 East Asian countries, and it's our great pleasure to provide a platform for Chu Yunhan to present these findings. So without further ado, Yunhan, why don't you come up and make some introductory remarks?
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming to this forum. I have collaborated in different capacity with Brookings, more specifically with Richard Bush, over many years. But this is my second time in my capacity as a coordinator of Asian Barometer Survey that we co-sponsor this event. I still remember that we did that for the first time 3.5 years ago when we just concluded our Wave 3 survey across East Asia. I think before we get started with the first panel, let me say a few words on behalf of our team. The Asian Barometer Survey is actually a research network that involves, I would say, more than 50 scholars across Asia, and also we also have many collaborators who are U.S.-based, including Andrew Nathan of Colombia. He will also speak on the first panel, and people like Larry Diamond at Hoover Institution. And this network was established as early as 1999, at the turn of the century. And initially, the network covered only a country and territory in East Asia. But since our second wave, you know, the survey has been expanded to include virtually every important political system in the region except North Korea, Laos, Brunei, and East Timor. So pretty much, I think we cover really the bulk of the region. And also, we have a partner in South Asia, and they are able to extend the survey to 5 countries in that part of the world. And in addition to that, there is another organization. The next layer of collaboration is among the regional barometer survey. I'm talking about Latino Barometer Arab Afro and Eurasia. So the five regional barometers together, you know, we also be able to collaborate at the global level on the auspice of Global Barometer Survey. And the ABS, the Asian Barometer Survey, was principally funded by Taiwan's Ministry of Education, and also the Ministry of Science and Technology, as well as the Academia Sinica. So it's actually a very much academic project, because it has been, you know, run by the scholar and senior member of the academic community. But also, I think the finding from our survey is of great relevance to many other stakeholders, including foreign policy makers, the mass media, the NGO leader, and also the donor organization. So for that reason, actually, oftentimes we were invited by EU, by World Bank, but also by UNDP and other and State Department from time to time to do the briefing, to share the data with them. And also the data is always released into public domain after 18 months embargo. So many scholars and experts has benefited from the fact that we have been able to deliver such rich data set, and also all the data they are collected through face-to-face interview and based on probability sampling that cover the entire country, which means that these surveys, they are very expensive. It's not, you know, it's very, very cumbersome in terms of administration. Imagine, you know, if you administer a countrywide survey in a country like Indonesia or China. You know, if you do survey, a countrywide survey in China, it's like covering the entire Europe, literally. Or even more complicated than that, you know. You also have to handle the challenge from, you know, the censorship and other factors. Without further ado, I simply, really looking forward to this morning deliberation. We will share with you the first time, you know, after we conclude the survey, just early part of this year. And I hope that, you know, the thing that we are going to report to you will be useful and enlightening. In particular, we do think that a bigger challenge for the next U.S. administration, whoever, you know, get elected in November, one of the biggest challenges is how to pick up where Obama has left off, you know, in terms of his pivot to Asia. We do think that the data that, you know, we're going to share with you will, you know, be a very useful empirical data, you know, for the next administration to formulate, you know, their priority in that part of the region of the globe. Thank you. I look forward to a wonderful symposium today. Yeah, thank you.
You get me for one more minute. My job at this point is to introduce the participants in the first panel. I will moderate. And then Juyun Han and our old friend Huang Minhua will present, right? Juyun Han is a distinguished research fellow at Academia Sinica. He's a professor of political science at National Taiwan University. He's also the president of the Zhang Jingguo Foundation. Minhua Huang is associate professor of political science at National Taiwan University, and a few years ago he was a visiting fellow here at Brookings in my center. Then as discussants, we have Andy Nathan, Columbia University political science professor, and he and I prefer not to talk about how long we've known each other. then Bruce Stokes of Pew Research Center, whom I've already mentioned. So we're going to start with some PowerPoint presentations. So if just the presenter would come to the podium and we'll proceed. I'm sorry? Is Professor John going to be a discussant or?
No, but he will join us.
Okay, fine. Zhang Yu Zhong is a professor of political science at National Taiwan University and director of the Center for East Asian Democratic Studies. So Yunhan, do you want to start?
Oh, wonderful. It works. For this panel, the first panel presentation, I would divide up the task between me and Minghua. I will provide the overall, analysis, and Minghua will dig deeper into the data, give you some, more penetrating understanding of what the data has shown us. Specifically, what the survey has done is to collect data from the ordinary citizen in the region. And we asked, not a whole lot of questions, but, it's a very demanding question, when it comes to international affairs, foreign policy. So all the questions have to be crafted, in a way that most people can understand, okay, and they can actually provide a meaningful answer to those questions. For specific, questions, we would like to offer some empirical data on it. Number one, which superpower, the United States or China, is perceived to be more influential in the region, okay? And number two, which superpower, the United States or China, is more welcome and better appreciated in terms of its leadership role, its impact on the region, for the, in the region. And number three, how East Asian perception has changed over the critical juncture of the last 4 to 5 years. And this juncture, pretty much is marked by two very important transitions. One is from Obama's first administration and to the second term, but he announced a pivot to Asia during his first term. But nevertheless, I think that the pursuit of this new priority has gone earnest, and with far more concentrated in terms of effort, energy during his second term. And the peak of this strategy is the conclusion of the TPP negotiation, and there's another important transition, even more significant, that also happened during this period of time, is the transition from Hu Jintao as a top leader of China to Xi Jinping, and everyone agree with me that Xi's leadership style. And his approach is evidently very different from his predecessor. And the last question, we want to deal with is what drives Asian people's view toward a rise in China. Although we can ask similar question about China, United States, but I think this would be the much more interesting question to tackle with. Let me, offer you some background, how we, size up, the leadership of Xi Jinping when it comes to foreign policy agenda. I think, I use the four, descriptive, statement. I think he governed over a more resourceful China. Okay, so the foreign policy enjoy, many, many more resources in terms of policy tool. And economic, chips and military chips, things like that, and more assertive, and more ambitious, and more aggressive. Okay, just give you a few highlights, in terms of why China become more resourceful. China is ever bigger, in terms of as economy. It has been nowadays a major source of foreign direct investment throughout the world, especially. In ASEAN, in 2015, actually, the China, the capital export is bigger than how much, foreign direct investment they attracted from abroad. And also, China becomes the number one source of tourist spending in the world, but also in particular in Asia. Let's just give you some sense how China become more resourceful. And also, apparently, under Xi Jinping, Chinese foreign policy become more assertive, You know, China now always, you know, when they talk to other foreign countries, you have to respect our core interests, okay? And the list of that core interests keep expanding. That include, you know, the not only, you know, the security, but also, you know, the issue of Tibet and Taiwan, things like that. And also China's more assertive in the sense that, you know, they put a lot of energy into projecting their own cultural soft power, in particular, you know, by setting up, you know, more than 500 Confucian institutes around the world, and also introduce their own, you know, CCTV, you know, 24-hour news channel, things like that. And also China want to actually drive the agenda when it comes to U.S.-China relationship by promoting their own concept of a new model of great power relations. And more recently, you know, you can see that China has been very assertive in exercising the leadership role over the global agenda, you know, for the G20 summit that have just been held in Hangzhou. They push vigorously for this document, you know, and known as the Hangzhou Consensus. And also, under Xi Jinping, China have launched many, many very ambitious global and regional strategy, which is not even conceivable, you know, a few years ago. For instance, that, you know, the you know, really ambitious, and you can say even say visionary, you know, One Belt One Road initiative, and also to you know, upgrade the visibility, the influence of Boao Forum. And also, you know, to set up this Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and in the end, more than 57 countries, you know, want to become the founding member of this multilateral lending agency. This is the first one since Bretton Woods that United States was not involved. So this really, you know, opened up a new page in terms of history, and also the enlargement of Shanghai Cooperation Organization, you know, by inviting both Pakistan and India to become former member of this regional security organization. And lastly, what I characterize as more aggressive, China has actually exercised less and less self-restraint in flexing its muscle, right? It's keep upgrading its military arsenal. There's already one aircraft carrier, another is under construction, three more, on the blueprint, and not to mention, you know, the rapid construction of those man-made reefs in South China Sea as a way to project, you know, its power over this very controversial territorial dispute, and many other, you know, the development, you know, the also, you know, convey very similar kind of message. Obviously, United States also, I think, have responded to a more assertive and more ambitious Chinese foreign policy. In various ways, and obviously, I think one of the hallmarks of Obama presidency is his pivot to Asia. Especially, I think, you know, this new approach have gone in earnest during his second term. United States also launched its own U.S.-ASEAN summit since 2013. And United States have improved its relationship with virtually every ASEAN country except Thailand. In particular, the relationship with Vietnam and Myanmar has been much improved over the last few years during his second term. And also, United States tried to regain its economic leadership, you know, concluding the TTP negotiation. Although the fate of the, you know, trade pact is still uncertain. And also, you know, the United States, obviously, once it put itself out of the Afghanistan, out of Iraq, you know, and become more concentrated and focused on Asia-Pacific, and it has upgraded, you know, its security relationship with Tokyo, with Australia, And also the announcement of rebalance to Asia, not to China, and with the deployment of Marine troops in Australia, you know, that hasn't happened for a long, long time. And also United States is the only country probably in the world, maybe Japan, you might include Japan as well, is willing to stand up to China over South China Sea dispute. So anyway, you know, so this is the larger, you know, context, you know, when I talk about the critical juncture over the last 3 or 4 years. And now we want to, you know, share with you some data how Asian people, they perceive those changes, you know, how they evaluate, you know, the leadership role of the United States versus China in the region. And also I have to tell you that there's not that many reliable empirical data, especially data, you know, they are designed around standardized instrument that has been, you know, standardized in every country and also being able to administer in many, many Asian countries. Obviously, Pew survey is one of them, but to my best knowledge, Pew doesn't cover every country in East Asia. It's very expensive, especially if you want to do face-to-face interview. But nevertheless, our data, you know, although the wording of the item is not identical, but I think they are functionally equivalent, and actually the finding from the Pew and our is quite consistent, you know, as far as those countries covered by both surveys, okay? So in that sense, Asian Barometer Survey does fill up a very important void, you know, that, you know, we policymakers do need reliable data, okay, and systematic, you know, data being collected in a scientifically reliable manner. And this is the survey that we have done in those countries during wave 3 and wave 4, roughly 4 year interval, you know, between the two surveys in every country. And most of the surveys, they are not entirely synchronized, but they are being able to conduct within roughly within a time frame of 18 months. So for the latest survey, some of them are conducting towards the second half of 2014, but most of them took place in 2015. And the latest, you know, was just concluded in the early part of this year. But this is a large-scale, very large-scale operation. It took a lot of time for us to do data, you know, consistent check, quality check, and all the cleaning. So only up until August this year, the data become really, you know, available in terms of analyzing it. Let me give you the first chart, okay? And this is a question about which country has the most influence in Asia now, okay? And the data, you know, you can show we have both wave 3 and wave 4. The bar in Y is from the wave 3. So this is a picture that in most Northeast Asian country, or countries who are immediate neighbor to China, the growing influence in China has been more intensely felt by those, you know, people in those countries. You know, like Vietnam, Taiwan, Mongolia, Japan, and Singapore, although it's, you know, a bit far away, but in a sense, you know, it's cultural and linguistic distance between Singapore and China is very close, right? And then, you know, the Korea and so on and so forth. So in those countries, a great majority, you know, during our both wave 3 and wave 4, they all think that China now has the most influence relative to the United States in the region. Okay, so this is their, you know, observation. But the story is somewhat different, you know, when it comes to Southeast Asia, you know, except Singapore, I just mentioned, that still, you know, a large number of respondent in South ASEAN countries, they still consider the United States, at least more people, you know, in those countries consider the United States still have is the most influential, you know, power in Asia. And also you see some not great deal of changes, but some interesting fluctuation over time among those Northeast Asian countries, because, you know, the number of people who believe China is already very most influential is already very big, you know, overwhelmingly majority. So it didn't stay that high. It actually had come down a little bit, little bit, between wave three and wave four, which means that between roughly 2011 and 2015, okay? However, the perception that China is the most influential country has make some gain, in ASEAN country. So there are slightly less people in countries like Cambodia still believe that United States is the most influential, and slightly less in the Philippines as well. But the only country that where the majority people still believe that the United States is the most influential as recent as wave four is only the Philippines. The only country where United States, in terms of, this kind of objective assessment still enjoy upper hand, okay? Although the number between the two charts, they don't necessarily add up to 100%, because some people say, I don't know, it's difficult to tell, okay? There are some residual answer, and some tiny minority, they might say Japan is most influential, but these are really exceptional, okay? So usually people either say China, United States, or I don't know, okay? Or hard to tell, okay? Then if we ask a question, which country will have the most influence in 10 years, okay, projection into the future, then I have to say that even greater number of people, overwhelming majority, especially in Northeast Asia, okay, that they tend to think that China will become the most influential country in the region versus the United States. And fewer people, still think that the United States will remain the most influential in the region, except in the Philippines. But even in the Philippines, the number have come down from 65% believing United States still the most influential to 57. Okay, so this is by and large, what has happened, over the last 4 years. However, even though a lot of people who perceive China is more influential than the United States, but which country their role, their leadership is more welcome, okay, then the picture is very, very different. Okay, so this is the good news for U.S. policymaker. The blue bar is, people who think, very positively or favorably about the U.S. impact on the region. Okay, so in the Philippines, 92%, overwhelmingly, in Vietnam, 90%, Myanmar, 86%, Cambodia, 85%, Korea, 83%, Mongolia, 80%, and so on and so forth. However, I do want to register, some qualification. It's not the case in the two Muslim countries, dominantly Muslim country in the region. Indonesia, only 45%, and Malaysia, only 50%, okay? I think it does have something to do with, the U.S. Middle East policy and the troubled relationship between United States and the Muslim world, in general. That would be my, intuitive interpretation. But on the other hand, it's not always a zero-sum game. Say, maybe in Japan it is, okay? But in countries like Korea, obviously, Korean can think, China and United States, they are all welcome, for their influence. And same thing, can be said about Thailand. Even in Taiwan, even though, obviously people who favor U.S. role much more, 73%, but there's still, 55% who think that, the role, of, the impact of China on the region is largely favorable, okay, or welcome, okay. And then we have parallel question about, the impact of United States or China on their own country. The previous one is about on the region, okay. Pretty much a similar picture, okay, similar picture. But nevertheless, I think, but United States is still favored, okay, in this bilateral relationship by a great majority of Asian citizens, even among Malaysian and Indonesia, still. Although in four country and territory where China is slightly, more favored in United States, Thailand, and also Hong Kong and Malaysia and Indonesia. Okay, Otherwise, you know, United States is still our favorite by Asian. And also, we can tell you a little bit about the changes over between the two surveys when it comes to, you know, how they view the Chinese influence on the region. Obviously, people in China felt very good about themselves, right? They think their influence on the region is almost 100%. Say, you know, it's positive. You know, it's constructive. But you can tell that the more assertive, or the more you might say, you know, even more aggressive approach on the Xi does cause some erosion, a substantial erosion of its, you know, its soft power in the region. Look at the Philippines. Okay, between 4 years, people who have a favorable view about the Chinese role in the region have dropped from 73% to only 41%. Okay, so this is, you know, very dramatic, you know, very dramatic, but for the reason, you know, people in the room, you know, fully understand. And same thing happened to Vietnam, right? It's not a very great, you know, relationship to begin with, okay, but now it's in a worse shape. Japan, you know, is familiar. You know, this China is the least liked, country among the Japanese, right? Around 2011, only 19 people, you know, think positively about China, but now only 11%. And Myanmar, this is the first time we are able to do a survey in Myanmar just recently. Okay, not that many people, you know, have great admiration for Chinese leadership in the region. But it has probably something to do with, because this survey was conducted before the last general election, before the founding election, before Aung San Suu Kyi, you know, came to power. So I think the resentment toward China has a lot to do with their resentment toward the military regime, because they believe that China is actually the principal backer of the unpopular, very unpopular regime, the military regime. But nevertheless, but on the other hand, there are a few cases that the Chinese, the favorite image have risen in case of Thailand. So as I mentioned, Thailand is the only country that did not improve its relationship due to the military coup. And the data was collected after the coup, okay? Because now Thailand had been much more, disfavored by many Western countries, the coup and also the violation of human rights and other deplorable record. And Korea, but Korea, I have to caution you that although, you know, the image trend have improved a lot between the 2011 and 2015, but I don't know about Seoul, you know, after Seoul, whether, you know, this huge, you know, tension might whether this high, you know, favorable image, you know, can be sustained. I don't know, but we need another survey to find out. So anyone who wants to pay for it, you know, we are more happy to do it. but nevertheless, I would say China does pay some price, you know, over the territorial dispute in South China Sea. Okay, I know how good I am doing time-wise. Okay, good. Let me just share a few other charts with you, you know, then I will hand over to Minghua. Another, just this chart just compare our finding, you know, in four countries that we overlap: Japan, Korea, Indonesia, and China. I didn't include the latest, you know, the 2016 Pew survey, but we will do that later on. But nevertheless, I can say that the items, the wording item is not identical, but they are function equivalent. At least the pecking order is almost the same. Japan, you know, is where China was least favored, you know, and so on and so forth. So this corroborate, you know, in terms of validity. Although Minghua will give you a more penetrating analysis in what drives people's perception about rising China. Okay, but let me just share you with this one chart, which is crystal clear. But although this is not a perfect linear relationship, but nevertheless, it does give you some sense that for people, who This is between, you know, the how they perceive, you know, whether they perceive positively the role of China versus, you know, the percentage of people who think the country is doing great economically. You know, they are doing fine economically, okay? So what this chart tells you is that, you know, in Japan, a great number of people, they don't like China, but also a great number of people, they don't think the economy is doing well. Okay, so this actually, you know, have a very interesting, you know, linear relationship. For countries that, you know, they favor your, you know, Chinese role in the region, also at the same time, you know, they are happen to be a country, a large number of people living in the country, they think the economic condition is quite good or has been improved, you know, over the last few years. So you might actually, although, you know, this have to be qualified, you know, if we bring other consideration, you know, geostrategic consideration, ideological consideration. But I would say, you know, as far as, you know, this, you know, economic consideration concerned, the risk and benefit brought about, you know, expanding economic tie with China has distributed very unevenly, especially in Northeast Asia, where the income is much higher, okay? In many ways, they are pressured, you know, under the Chinese competition. So the popular view over the nature of China impact has become polarized, especially in Northeast Asian country, where labor, farmer, office worker feel the economic squeeze more strongly. Okay, but by and large, I would say, and also something I already mentioned that China's growing influence in the region is more intensely felt by countries that are geographically or culturally proximate to China, especially in Northeast Asia. But also there's some significant change over time under Xi Jinping. But also, you know, you can readily pick up that, you know, the perception of declining influence of the United States become more widespread in Thailand and Malaysia. But China have lost a lot of ground, you know, winning the approval in the case of the Philippines and Vietnam. Let me say a few, just a few words about the Muslim perception toward United States. This is the breakdown between the three ethnic groups in Malaysia. Okay, the ethnic Chinese, the Malay, and Indian. The Chinese Malaysia usually they are more likely to think that China is more influential than the United States, more so than Malay. And also, they have a very favorable view about the role of China in the region. However, it is among the Malay who consider the role of the United States, doing more harm than good, or doing much more harm than good, and more so than ethnic Chinese, much more so. Okay, so this simply, you know, back up, you know, what I have just said earlier, that, you know, the image of the United States among the Muslim populace in the region, primarily, you know, Malaysia and Indonesia, is not very encouraging. And we can apply this kind of subnational analysis to every country, right? But we don't have time to go into that. But since I'm from Taiwan, the whole project headquartered in Taiwan, well, I have to say something about, you know, distribution of popular view on Taiwan. We have the three camp, right? The blue camp, the green camp, and the independent, okay? Obviously, the blue camp voter are more likely to consider China is the most influential, okay? More so than the green and the independent, okay? But still, even among the green, I have to say, the majority believe that U.S. is already more influential than China, than the United States, even among the green camp, okay? And also their view about the role of China and the role of the United States, obviously, you know, the blue camp usually, they tend to take a more favorable assessment about China, the role of China, and obviously DPP and green camp follower, they they definitely much more welcome and appreciate the role of the United States. Okay, so if I were Ma Ying-jeou, you know, under this kind of popular opinion constraint, I would try to maintain, you know, good relationship with both, with China and United States, because they are both favored by his constituency. But it's not an entire story for the Tsai Ing-wen, right? Because only one third of her camp, you know, favored China, but three quarter of her camp favored the United States. Okay, so the different approach, you know, undertaken by the two administration is fully understandable. Last thing is that it's not, as I mentioned earlier, that it's not necessarily a zero-sum game. Okay, in a lot of country, a lot of people can favor United States and China at the same time. So it's not necessary the China's rules become U.S. game. Maybe that's the case, you know, like in Japan, definitely, okay, or even Mongolia, but not in many other countries. So actually, the two measures, favorable, unfavorable, you know, positive, negative, they are actually correlated between, you know, how they view China and how they view United States, which means that some people, they tend to take either a benign view about both great power, or they might take a skeptical view toward both. Give you one example. You know, when it comes to economic openness, okay, people who oppose economic openness, they don't view United States very favorably. Okay, because United States will be blamed for, you know, those overarching framework, right? Opening up the market, you know, globalization. But China will not be viewed favorably either, because China is a source of the competition. Okay, they squeeze them out. Okay, the export, you know, things like that. So this is a complicated story, a very complicated story. Nevertheless, I would say, let me conclude right here, sorry. The challenge opportunity for the next president of the United States. I think to exert its leadership role in the region, the United States is facing the headwind of a widespread perception of the declining influence of the United States versus the rising China. This is objective obstacle, you know, United States or the leadership have to overcome. Because this expectation, if the building, if it cannot be reversed, will make U.S. policy commitment less persuasive or credible. Okay. However, I do want to give some credit to Obama's pivot to Asia. I think the kind of effort and priority, you know, he have given to Asia have sorted the trend in the perception, but didn't reverse it in a significant way, but at least sorted, okay, that perception. And opportunity for the United States is still great, because the United States' role is far more welcome and appreciated in great majority of Asian countries, with exception of Thailand and Muslim country. And also with the growing apprehension of China's strategic intent, the U.S. role might even be viewed as indispensable. In some cases, China has pushed its neighbors into the arm of the United States. Thank you for your attention. Yeah.
My name is Minghua Huang. I'm colleague of Yunhan and National Taiwan University, Department of Political Science. My job here is within 10 minutes give you some kind of causal analysis to explain why people think that U.S. or China has most influence in China. And I, you know, when I just sit in the seats, I have do a lot of thought exercise how to condense my presentation. So I'm going to give you a very brief story about this. Basically, our analytical framework has three parts. One is about geopolitical or security consideration. But a lot of this, actually, for the past 4 years, not changing that money, because if you look at the factors that we enumerated. But there's one factor I want to put here, which is what we call the democracy factors. And later on, I will tell you, in terms of political aspects, the competition of political system of democracy versus autocracy, these kind of factors play out very important to the advantage of U.S. presence in Asia. So U.S. need to think about in what aspect they want to put more resources in the presence of Asia. It's economic aspect, it's a political democracy aspect, or its economic aspects. And the other is the economic consideration. Later on, I will tell you China understands their economic advantage and their powerful influence over all neighboring countries in Asia. And that economic strategy actually works to sway people's more positive view about China. So in that regard, so far, I don't see U.S. put a lot of active roles trying to increase their the presence in Asia. And there are a lot of resistance now, I know, in the Congress, maybe in the next president. And in that regard, it's really troublesome for the United States. And the rest will be cultural consideration. We should not underrate the cultural factors as well. And later on, I will show you in the PowerPoint slide, actually the cultural proximity during those Asian neighboring countries tend to give a credit to China's rise. They tend to a little bit more benign, or at least they're willing to trust the benign nature of China's rise. All right, so the three factors conclude how we should compare the China and U.S. The being perceived in Asia. I'm going to skip a lot of this. I just want to show you some figures to illuminating my points here. And this figure is very simple. This is what we call democratic distance. And this actually is, we're asking respondent how you rated China's democratic level and rated your own country's democratic level. In this table, mostly China would be rated the least democratic countries in all of our survey here. And so here you see there's a negative relationship, which means that if they are rating for China not that negative, much more democratic than other countries, then they will tend to have positive view about China's perception, the China's influence. So which means in a country which not that democratic or they rated China not that authoritarian, they tend to have positive view about China. So this is what I saw, what I'm telling you, the democracy, the competitions of democratic system actually is important, because when people living in much more authoritarian countries, they were rated China not that authoritarian, they tend to have positive view about China. But this is wave four. That's wave three. This is wave four. It has changing. Why is changing? If you actually look at the right bottom figure, originally negative relationship now become flat, which means that no more. This kind of consideration toward China is now probably more not that relevant in terms of a democratic perception. But on the other hand, U.S. still have an overwhelming strategy advantage in the upper left the figure. Here, telling you, because U.S. democratic level in all our ratings, all country rating is much higher. Everybody thinks U.S. are more democratic than our own countries. So in a context where people rate the U.S. are much more democratic than their own countries, they will have a much more positive evaluation or perception about U.S. influence. So the suggestion here is that U.S. should maintain this kind of strategy. They have relatively advantage in terms of their democratic system. People still view U.S. as a role model in terms of democracy. And that is really important to increase people's perception, positive perception about U.S. role in Asia. And then this story is about, traditionalism. The vertical line here actually labeled wrong. The higher, which means that they are not that, they are more modern. And if they are lower one, which means they are more traditional. Here you see China is very traditional in our measures here. So in terms of much traditional one, which they are cultural more proximate to China's, so you will see much positive image, the perception about China. So which means cultural proximity actually favor in China's side. But in terms of U.S., this very slight positive is not significant at all. So culturally speaking, China still had advantage to win the hearts and mind people have the trust on China's benign nature in terms of their rights. All right? So then we turn to the economic factors. It's very simple. This is for economic openness. For whoever think that they support economic openness in terms of country level, you will see positive perception about U.S. as well as China. It's all positive. at nearly the same rates, right? So in economic speaking, no matter in which countries, if they agree they want more economic openness, they will tend to rate China as well as the U.S. more positively. So it's economic gain as well. This one actually is also about economics. That one, this one's economic condition, sorry. It's about how well you are in terms of your perceived economic conditions. So it's all positive. This one is economic openness as well as positive. But in this figure, if you actually look closely, China's slope is much steeper than the U.S. So which means that China's in economics, this regard, has even more influential roles to swaying people's perception in a positive directions. So economy is the key, and China in this regard has advantage. The last one here actually is about, democratic value. And this one actually is about respondents. They have a lot of view about value, right? And so if they are more liberal, they will be in a much higher in vertical places. If they have lower, they are not that liberal democratic views, they will be in the lower parts. It's not really that matter at all. So it doesn't matter whether in this country they are more democratic or not democratic in their value system. It doesn't matter. So the rest, I'm going to give you a picture, but not picture, it's a finding, but it's a little bit technical. If you actually look at the result of our finding, it's about U.S. macro factors, trade with China or cultural distance, whether they will affect people's view on U.S. impact. No, nothing. You don't see stars, no factors, no relationship at all. But if you actually look at China in wave four, you will see trade and cultural distance of the impact comparing to the third wave actually is the negative relationship is going down. So which means that originally if a country have a much great volume in terms of trade with China, they will view China's rise more negatively. But that kind of relationship goes weaker or gone. Nothing. So my story here is very simple. I don't PowerPoint at all, and I need 1 minute to conclude. It's very simple. It's again about the competition of political system versus again a competition about economic influences. At this moment, I don't see U.S. understand their economic presence in China is the key. It's very important. And I'm not sure whether U.S. knows they need to maintain that the most democratic perception still being perceived in Asia. That is important too. But I know China, they don't care about competition or political system. They know they can keep on playing the game of economy. They were swinging more positive view in their favor. But there's a footnote here. We have some case studies showing once you push too far, they will have backlash. For example, in Myanmar, it used to be there are big economic projects. You see the hydropower plant. You see a northern, there will be a lodging industry. You see there are gas and oil pipeline. It's not working that well as we thought. Why? Because there are a lot of Myanmar people. They are thinking China's presence is predatory. It's not helping Myanmar to become better. It's actually more predatory, and they team up with those higher military dictatorship. So in that regard, in Myanmar, actually it's a bad case. But I'm just telling you, generally speaking, China knows what they are doing, and they are doing well, and our data is showing this, and I hope U.S. knows how to compete with China in the Asia-Pacific region, and two key, which is still that Asian people believe U.S. the most democratic country in the world. Shouldn't throw out a lot of policy for Asian people hurt their feeling and think the U.S. not that democratic. The second one was U.S. needs to consider to put more resource instead of military presence. Of course, we need that, but not that much. You need to actually to economically engage with Asia, have more tight relationship in competition with China. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. That was great. You guys, I'm part of the Asian Barometer, but I haven't participated in the design of these questions or the analysis, so this is all a surprise to me. And I know we're running short of time, so let me just make a few short points. First of all, whenever you design surveys, you face the problem that there isn't enough room in the survey to ask all the questions that you would like to ask. So I think here we've learned a great deal and we want to know more. And I think what I want to know more about, and I know we don't have space and we're not going to do this in the survey methodology, but this dependent variable of favorability, you're forcing the respondent to condense a whole probably very multidimensional and ambivalent set of attitudes into one answer. You have to do that in a survey. I understand that. But when we ask people, so we seem to have two dependent variables, at least that were reported here, who has more influence, which is also multidimensional, but more so the favorable. So a person may feel that it's favorable impact from many different angles, whether it's, as you have pointed out correctly, you know, strategic, economic, cultural, political, and so forth and so forth. So when we have that DV, it's the respondent is condensing all of these things into it. The use by the analysts of all the independent variables that over the years since we've done the four waves, we've built up all of these independent variables. Some of them are obvious, you know, gender, how favorable is your economic condition, country, family, and all that stuff that we've built up for other purposes. The traditional social value battery, the liberal democratic value battery that you now, Minhua, is using them as independent variables. Great, very creative how you've done that. So I love that. And what are the big picture things that I came away with, not having even seen all of Minhua's, as we all did not see all of his slides because of time? I came away with several bottom lines provisionally, depending upon studying this stuff more closely. One is that Asians want both. I mean, and these are not surprising. I think they sort of support a conventional wisdom that the countries around China want a balance of power in Asia between China and the United States. They want both. They don't want either one to be dominating. So I think we kind of already knew that. A second thing I came away with is this confirms an impression that I think we've gotten from other sources that Asian people see the handwriting on the wall, which is China's economy is growing, even though it's slowed down, it continues to grow, and the United States growth is much slower. And you know, whether you like it or you don't like it, China's going to be a big factor and has been and will continue to be a big factor in the economies of Asian countries. And then one of the questions, I think Yunhan alluded to it, and I'm sure Minhua can analyze it more down, because what you have shown us is countries as units of analysis on these charts. But if we go into the country and we look at the individual, like you said in one of your slides, what is your job, what is your particular income and your particular economic optimism or not, you're going to be able to see the cleavages within each country, as and you did it with the Malays, the Indians, and the Chinese or Muslims and others within each country with respect to their, let's say, economic interest in the impact of this country or that country or of simply openness. And as you said, both China and the U.S. are associated with openness in all of these countries. So those who are against openness are going to be against both. But anyway, in general, Asians would like a balance of power in the region. They see the economic handwriting on the wall. One of the things that isn't as clear to me now, and I think we can get to it, is the strategic position. The long-term strategic position is that at least since 1975, people in Asia have doubted the U.S. strategic commitment to the region because the U.S. is far away, China's nearby. The U.S. Commitment to Japan and South Korea depends on this kind of implausible thing called the nuclear umbrella, you know, and which nobody has ever quite fully believed in anyway. So doubts about the U.S. and the knowledge that, but the thing is, as the strategic friction, the strategic ballet goes, you know, like the South China Sea, these are very fast moving things. How fast do Asian attitudes respond to, you know, Marines in Darwin, Australia, little things like that? Does the public pay attention to this? I think is difficult to know how much impact it has. Final point I want to make is about, so Minhua emphasized, I think it was Minhua emphasized the importance, well, both of you, of political values. And I think what you were saying is the American democracy image has an appeal. Now, leaving aside the current election and the mess of that, leaving that, and that is important, but leaving that out for a moment, and let's say that, let's hope that the image of the U.S. as a functioning democracy would persist. Here's a problem. If we have a good image, if democratic values have an appeal, how to build on that? So Yunhan said this is one of your slides, challenge and opportunity slide. This is a positive asset. How can that asset be put to use? I really don't know. Is it more like propaganda, VOA, RFA? Is it more educational exchange or something? This is really, is it more, I'm on the board of the NED as well, and it's something that the NED, well, the NED is not involved with promoting the image of the United States, but it's involved in the project of trying to advance democracy. So there's some overlap here with this puzzle. How do you do that? So that's very fascinating, and you open up that for our discussion. Okay, thanks.
I too really appreciated both of these presentations, and I think as was mentioned, I mean one of the strengths of public opinion research is not to have a single survey, but to have multiple surveys and then make comparisons and see where they compare, where they don't, try to methodologically figure out why they may differ, maybe timing and maybe other things. But certainly, I think that the complementarity of the Asian Barometer and the Pew Research Global Attitudes Project, I think, reinforce each other, not the least of which because we ask slightly different questions sometimes. So that allows us, I think, to tease out some of these differences between countries. But I certainly applaud the Asian Barometer because you do cover more countries than we do. And I think that's terribly useful. I only wish we could. We have asked some of the same questions. We find that about 6 in 10 Asians in the 10 countries that we have surveyed have a favorable view of the United States, but this can vary widely across countries. What is interesting is that the Chinese perception of the United States is higher than the U.S. perception of China. Which I find quite interesting. We didn't get into some of the generational differences, but we do find, and I think find this very interesting, that both in the perceptions of the U.S. and of the perceptions of China, young people in most countries have a more positive view of the other. In other words, young Americans have a more positive view of China than older Americans do, and young Chinese have a more positive view of the United States than older people in China, and you see that in a number of other countries. And it does raise interesting questions, it seems to me, to pursue about, are these generational differences merely the reflection that young people are naive and idealistic, or is it that they are just more accepting of the world than people of my generation? They have no memories of the Cold War or the bamboo curtain or whatever you want to, Red China, whatever. And as a result, there is a potential here for greater complementarity working forward. China is not as well favored around Asia, at least in our surveys, but still about a median of 54% to have a favorable view of China. Again, it varies widely. The Japanese are off the charts in terms of their unfavorability towards China. We find some of the same findings you did, that a majority of the publics that we survey think that China's impact on the economy of their country is a good thing. The Vietnamese don't think that, for example. The Indians don't think that. But for the most part, people do. Although I can tell you, we just released last week a survey of a new survey, the 2016 survey of India. And what was striking is that almost every aspect of China that we asked the Indian public about, they saw negatively, very negatively. And the numbers were so consistent, I think that it, you know, China is just a dirty word in India right now. And I think if we ask people in India, do they think that, you know, the Chinese helping the sun come up in the morning is a good thing, that people would be against it because China was in the question. So I do, but it is quite fascinating that you've got that kind of negativity in India of all places. Basically, overwhelmingly, people in Asia do not see China's rise militarily as a good thing. That ranges from 96% of the Japanese to 68% of the Filipinos. It's really quite widespread. Leave you with two things in our surveys that I think are most troublesome and also thought-provoking. We ask people about territorial disputes with China, and do you think that this would lead to military conflict? And I can tell you we've asked this question twice all over Asia. One was, do you think it's a serious problem? People overwhelmingly said yes. So we toughened the question the second time. So do you think it's going to lead to military conflict? And again, people overwhelmingly said yes. And by overwhelmingly, I mean 85% of the Japanese, 83% of the Koreans, 72% of the Indians, 84% of the Vietnamese. Everyone is worried about this. And I must say, one of the more disturbing findings in this question was that 6 in 10 Chinese think it's going to lead to military conflict. Now, my guess is, again, one of the limitations of survey research is you don't know what the respondent's thinking when you ask them a question. They may see themselves as the victim of that. I mean, somehow our benign intentions are going to lead to military conflict. But nevertheless, the Chinese are also worried about, the Chinese public is also worried. On the U.S. question, we have asked people a number of questions both in Asia and in the United States about the U.S. commitment to Asia. In our three main allies, Japan, South Korea, and Philippines, the majority of the population does believe that the United States would come to their defense in a war against China. Now, we can debate whether that, in fact, would actually happen, but the publics have drunk the Kool-Aid. They believe that. They also welcome the U.S. defense pivot to Asia. Majorities in almost every country welcome it. Interestingly, not the Malaysians, which I find fascinating, but the Filipinos, the Vietnamese certainly, the Japanese, the Koreans believe that the pivot to Asia, however you define that, because obviously it's fairly ill-defined, is positively received. I can tell you we ask Americans, would you go to the defense of our Asian allies if they were attacked by China? And a majority of Americans say they would. Now, I would caution you, it's a majority of Republican Americans. It's not a majority of Democratic Americans. And we find this with NATO as well, by the way, where Republicans are much more willing to go to the defense of NATO allies than Democrats, which suggests to me that we're really getting here is a Democratic and a Republican split on the use of military force. But we can't prove that. Finally, what's interesting is how the Chinese perceive all of this. And basically, the whole question of containment, is America really out to contain us? We don't use the word containment in the question, but we have found that a majority of Chinese say the U.S. is trying to prevent China from becoming as powerful as the U.S. So there is this sense that the American pivot to Asia has made China a victim inside China, is the view. So I think it's another interesting finding to contemplate. But thank you so much. Yeah.
Oh.
Thanks to all of you for great presentations. We have about half an hour for questions. I see you back there. Please identify yourself, and the mic will come to you, or the mic, wait for the mic, identify yourself, and ask a brief question. And if you want it to go to a specific person, that's fine. Bruce Stokes, Andy Nathan, Minhua, Yunhan, and Professor Zhang are all targets here. So I think that's Jonathan Pollock in the back, yes.
Yes, this is Jonathan Pollock from Brookings. My question is actually to Yunhan, and I hope it doesn't seem too obvious. You use the term influence or influential. Could you, as we say, unpack that a little? What do you mean by influence? Is there an operational definition? Is it what different Asians think of when they first place they think of in the morning when they wake up? What is influence? And even though we recognize, obviously, influence comes in a variety of forms.
We don't have operational definition because this is a issue of perception. So you cannot program your respondent. So you have to understand the term this way rather than the other way. It's not doable in survey. But we think that you know, there are a number of other choices, like more powerful, or exercise more leadership, things like that. But eventually, we settle down on which country has the most influence in the region. We think this expression in all language is most neutral. It doesn't suggest, you know, it's a, you play a you know, a very benevolent view or malevolent, you know. So and easy to be understood by the general public. Although, as I think Andy has said, you know, this. There's so much that survey can do. So it's not a good question if you design a questionnaire for the elite, for opinionated people. You know, you can obviously design a much wider, you know, the set of questions and dig their, you know, different component, different aspect of their overall impression China more deeply. But I think for survey research. Usually, actually, more generic question and using the common sense language, the better. But I think the fact that, you know, the relationship that we have identified, it makes so much sense, suggests that, you know, people don't, you know, actually misunderstood our question, you know, substantially, you know, in a significant way. Actually, I think they do, by and large, capture, you know, what we try to measure. Yeah.
I'm Paul Hare, most recently from the MIT Center for International Studies. If I could briefly ask two questions. There was a lot that was said about the U.S. perceptions of the U.S. commitment. Does the data or comments from the other members of the panel allow us to distinguish between regional perceptions of our commitment and regional perceptions of our capacity in terms of resources and attention span to sustain it over the long term? The second question is it correct to interpret Minhua's comments as leading to the conclusion that the economic factor is becoming, over time, more decisive than the political one?
First one. Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, we didn't ask question about credibility. We wish we had, especially if we can do a more focused survey on this issue alone. But unfortunately, given our resource constraint, you know, we have to, you know, also allocate space for so many other important questions. You know, we want to collect data on. So, but we do ask them about capacity. You know, I think the influence question is about capability. Okay, overall speaking. Okay, and then the question about, you know, how they evaluate the impact of the United States on the region, you know, they do much more harm, good than harm, you know, more harm, more good than harm, and somewhat more harm than good, and much, you know, harm than good.
give you a thermometer measure, you know, favorable, you know, whether they welcome or appreciate your leadership. But again, I said, you know, that's what the two angle we can offer you, but not really. It's not about credibility. Yeah. But nevertheless, I think if people tend to, if a great majority of people in Asia, they perceive that U.S., you know, relatively speaking, have a declining influence, it inevitably will lead to the next question, you know, how credible U.S. commitment, you know, to the region. Yeah.
Question in the back. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Short answer, yes. And the reason is that I think the past 6 years, I mean, our finding actually showing the economic factors driving more changes in terms of how the perception is changing, relatively comparing to other factors. So I think it's important. But I also add a footnote. Too much economics influences probably will bring negative backlash as well. So, but I don't think in most countries now at that tipping point. So still, China's influence is growing in terms of economic aspects. Yeah.
Well, it's my impression that the the influence of Chinese investment in a country is usually positive. The influence of Chinese exports to that country is often negative. Yeah, please.
Both of these questions have to do with the dependent variable. And I'd like to ask Bruce. So as you ask more and more specific questions, like as Jonathan said, if we were to ask people, and I didn't design these questions, something like, how big is the U.S. economic influence, strategic influence, this influence and that influence and capacity, influence in the past, future, and so forth. Respondents' answers become less meaningful because they don't know, most people. They don't think like people think in Brookings. So I wonder whether what your experience has been about how far you can drive the DV and still get a meaningful instead of a, people, when they answer surveys, they make up answers. The next day they give the opposite answer because they don't remember. So yeah. What level
no,
is
I, look, I think it's the dirty little secret of public opinion research that we all as consumers of public opinion research, and let's face it, you wouldn't be here if you weren't a consumer of public opinion research, and frankly, you're too rational. You're not an average person. We're talking about knocking on the door of some farmer in rural Philippines and saying, gee, what do you think about the United States? And, you know, it's not like he's laid awake night thinking, well, somebody comes to my door, you know, what am I going to say, you know, about the credibility of the U.S. Navy? I mean, it's just, it's too, and the reality, and as Andy says, studies have shown people often will give you an answer because they don't want to appear stupid and they want to be, you know, they want to be congenial to this stranger who came to their door, but they don't really, they've never thought about it before. So it's a tension. On one hand, you ask too general questions, you get mush, and you can get answers that you, when you get it back, you say, "My God, what does this mean? I have no idea what this means." But you know, I mean, one of the problems and I'm sure you guys would agree. I mean, one of the problems with influence is, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing that China has rising influence? and that's why you have to dig down a little deeper. But you're right. If you try to dig down too deep, you'll either get really high don't knows, or you will get answers that, frankly, you are suspicious of because people cannot have firm views about these things. That they're just, and especially on these international issues. I mean, the reality is when you ask people about problems in their country. Everybody has an opinion about the problems in their country, you know. Everybody will have an opinion about the leadership of their country, the direction of the country. Those are big issues that everybody has an accurate or inaccurate view on. But we've been doing a series of surveys in Asian countries about how people in those countries see their place in the world, because we want to compare that to how the Europeans see their place in the world, how the Americans see their place in the world. And, well, we think it's terribly important to begin to do this, but I'll tell you, on some of these questions, you get really high don't knows because the average person isn't quite, maybe you're not even so sure they're in the world, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there is that real challenge. And that's the limitation of public opinion research.
Okay, I had a question in the back, and then I'll move up to the front.
Thank you. My name is Atsushi Yamakoshi. I'm from Keidan, USA, from Japan. Going back to the influence issue, I think at least we need to kind of clarify political influence and economic influence, simply speaking. And can we assume that, you know, for most people, Chinese economic influence is reality, undeniable, and maybe favorable, but political influence is quite different, maybe cautious or unfavorable. So if this assumption is right, how do you think we should deal with that situation? Thank you.
Okay. On one hand, you definitely can ask those kinds of questions, you know, economic influence, political influence, military influence. But I have to caution, you know, you that, you know, as Andy, you know, just said, you know, the ordinary people, they don't necessarily think, perceive things in those abstract terms. You know, political. You know, what do you mean by political? Whether you have a state visit, or, you know, the other, whether, you know, China can dominate the UN agenda. You know, for elite, you know, that definitely, you know, they can have come up with a very, I should say, a consistent, coherent view of those things. But I really will caution. But on the other hand, I do want to say that if you do want to ask questions about any particular country, you know, their influence, you know, their role, I would say United States and China are the only two, maybe Japan, maybe, you know, or in the future, maybe India, that common people do have certain view on it. But it's everywhere, right? You know, if open, you turn on your TV, you know, you have news about United States and in China, and you walk around, you have tourists, you know, and so on and so forth, okay? And then you have the Seventh Fleet, right, you know, patrolling the region, you know, and widely covered, and, you know. So I do think that it's not as abstract, as remote as many other countries, at least these several, you know, I say the great power, especially China, you know, they are visible, say enough to have common people do have some kind of impression, and remember that, you know, I showed you the chart that between the 2011 and 2015, how big a drop of the favorable view toward China, you know, has occurred in the Philippines. It tells you that people do react to the, you know, changes. You know, there's a very significant change in the overall political environment. Yeah.
I want to add a footnote here. I think our analysis generally reflect that the people really think China's economic rise is opportunity. And that opportunity they can gain in their own favor. But when I say there, people, a lot of places also understand all the Chinese economic influence behind there's a political intention attached. It just matter whether that kind of political intention people can really identify, know what it is, and know whether it's a threat or not. Let me give you a case. For example, in Myanmar, in Taiwan, people really suspicious about that kind of economic influence or have serious political implications. But they are in other places probably not. For example, like Thailand, U.S. support is reducing. And so they need to grasp others' political influence support. So they don't really care about China's increased economic influence because so what? That's good. Yeah, someone support us economic-wise, military-wise, and political-wise. Our old friends just distant us away. So what I'm saying is that I think generally people do understand that kind of political intention attached, whether it's good or not. If they cannot tell, then they usually will treat it as benevolent. So I think I answer your question in this way, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Mark Tokola from the Cory Economic Institute. This was not covered in your data, but I'm curious to what extent public opinion is influenced by what the governments tell them it ought to be. To be cynical, is it better for the U.S. to try to influence the public, or better try the U.S. to get the government to say nice things about the U.S.?
It obviously it worked both ways. It's the public opinion view over international affairs is many studies have shown that heavily influenced by the leader, by the policy of the government, and also by opinion leader. But at the same time, in the age of cyberspace and internet, I would say the reverse causal path might still, you know, also credible, which means that people can spread all kind of view, you know, widely, and then you know, and then the leader, you know, also have sometimes to respond to. For instance, the Diaoyu Tai that dispute. You know, actually, some NGO group, the grassroots movement in Taiwan, Hong Kong, and in Japan as well. You know, actual, you know, the right wing. You know, they you know, rally the mass and drove the agenda, and the government have to, you know, to respond to. You know, to avoid being looked down upon. You know, by the general public. Yeah. So it worked both ways. Yeah.
I mean, my sense is that more broadly, you can rent goodwill, but you can't buy it. that individual events that often involve the government or the leader can change favorability one way or the other, but they tend to return to some kind of norm that there's reason to believe are driven by underlying things. So, for example, the favorability of the United States in India jumped dramatically when Modi came to the United States and was received lavishly, and Obama went to India in return. And then it returned to where it had been for the two previous years. So it does seem to me that it's voluble, but one shouldn't overinterpret that volubility because there's probably some underlying thing going on there. Okay.
I'm Vijayendra Kumar, and I was in research and development, and I'm currently retired. I'm somewhat confused about whether we're talking about hard power or soft power. Soft power, in my mind, is where people would like to immigrate, where people would like to send the children for education. So can you elaborate on that a bit?
Can you wait until the next panel? We will come to that.
Okay. Mike Fonte, and then we're going to go over to this side. Right.
Thanks. Mike Fonte, I'm the director of the DPP's mission here in Washington. Thanks for a great panel. I'm going to jump a little bit out of your data point of 2014. A lot has changed in Taiwan since with the elections. And I think when you talked about President Ma having kind of equal balance between blue and green, and he should lean both ways equally, I think some people in Taiwan didn't think he did that, but that's a different question. What I question is, do you think that Tsai Ing-wen's attempt to bridge the blue and green, which is what her stated objective is going to work given your data? I mean, I think she's trying that. I think she's trying that in way her appointments, her work with the cross-strait relations, and her work with the United States. But I wonder what your opinion is of that.
I think it's going to be challenging for President Tsai Ing-wen. But on one hand, you know, our political landscape is very much polarized. But I want to say that, you know, up to this point, she has been very cautious, very prudent, you know, and avoid any kind of unnecessary provocation. But nevertheless, Beijing can also drive the wedge, right? You know, creating tension within Taiwan by offering, you know, different carrot and stick, you know, to different constituency. So it's not entirely something, you know, that Tsai and her administration can really control, you know, over. And at the same time, I know this is beyond our topic. I think. there are other policy also might create the all kind of a bad feeling from the Brook camp, especially to go after the party asset. I think that's very divisive. But I know this is nothing to do with our survey, but so it's difficult, you know, in that kind of political setting, you know, try to build up yourself, you know, something like about policy and politics. I know it's how difficult it is in this country too, right? Yeah.
Professor Zhang or Minhua, do you have a comment on this?
No, that's fine.
Okay. Ray Burkhardt.
Hi, Ray Burkhardt from American Institute in Taiwan. I was very interested in the finding, if I heard it correctly, that the younger generation in China has a more favorable view of the United States than the older generation. Yeah, I mean, that's...
But also we have similar funding. We can show
okay,
you.
Okay, because it seems, contrary to a popular impression at least, that all the young netizens are extremely nationalistic and would be the first people to suggest... sending ships across the strait or going after the U.S. in the South China Sea and so forth. So maybe it shows that all of that is simply a popular impression that has no basis in fact. Any further surveys or observations to comment on that?
Ray, I think, thank you for bringing that point. I think that's the value of doing, probability sampling, countrywide survey, rather than simply, you monitor what has been talk about in the cyberspace. Sometimes it can be very much misleading. You know, you simply follow a view of those overzealous, the nationalists in China or any other place. Yeah.
And also, I think it's the value of repeating the survey year after year after year, because those are the finds we found year after year after year. So it's not just, in 1 year, for some reason we can't describe, this is the case. It is the case over time. But I would warn you, I mean, we don't know why that is, really. I think it has to do with the fact that young people all over the world came of age when globalization and internationalization is just a fact of life. And they're young and romantic and naive. And, maybe when they're middle-aged or older and they've had to live through, I don't know, trade wars or confrontations over military issues, they'll have a different view. We just won't know. I think we can be safe to say that people my age, we can kind of explain why their negativity might be there based on their life, what we know about their life experiences.
I've gone even further by stating what is essentially a hypothesis that millennials in various countries, whether it's Taiwan or China or the United States or European countries, have more in common with each other than they do with their parents' generation in each country. So American millennials have more in common with Taiwan millennials than each of them has with their parents. It's just a factor of our modern world. Back there.
Thank you. I am Ken Scalby from CSIS. I would like to ask Professor Chu, if I understand correctly, your survey shows that more Cambodian people perspective, U.S. has more influence in the region and than China, and more Filipino welcome U.S. Than China. I think it's very interesting if we compare it with the case of the South China Sea issue. The Cambodia is one of the countries which support China's stance, and the Philippines is new President Duterte is obviously seeking to better relationship with China. So how we should understand this difference between the prospect of general and the government direction? And especially I'm concerned of Philippines. In my understanding, the President Duterte is maintaining the high approval ratio. And so do you have any survey so how the presence of China or U.S. states in the region or on countries influence the general voting action? Thank you.
We know that the newly elected president in the Philippines is going to visit China. I think it will be a very important event.
Aquino, you know, obviously during his administration, the tension between the two have escalated, and China obviously also should take the blame, you know, for its their very, you know, military speaking, you know, very very assertive or even aggressive action in that region. But on the other hand, I think that maybe the new president might take a different approach, and whether this tension will continue to escalate or actually already reach the peak, and then the two might look at other area where they have potential opportunity for cooperation engagement. It's something worth waiting to see, and also how the next president that will sit in the White House to pick up where Obama has left off. I think these are the most important factor shaping, not only the relationship between the Philippines and the United States, or for that matter, Cambodia as well. I think that for countries that which are not, as I mentioned, they're immediately adjacent to China, usually the intensity of the growing influence in China usually would be less, proportionally. So that's probably the reason why countries like Cambodia and a few other ASEAN countries, they still view the United States as more influential. But their reference, frame of reference is the United States that have really, being the dominant power, the security order architect for more than half century, right? So this lingering impression, still have a long staying power. It won't be attenuated, dramatically. It might well in the long run, but not immediately. Yeah.
One last question, right here.
Hi, I'm Fernando Batista, Invest USC. And this probably is mainly for Minhua. The economic slide that you showed, if in the absence of the United States participating in TPP, how do you see that relationship?
I think different countries have their own economic situation. Some be influenced by they're eager to have this kind of trade pact. Some have already in, most of the ASEAN countries, they have already in. So what I'm saying is that, but whether in each condition, they all know that China is indispensable for their trajectory to continuing growth. So they need to piggyback on their chances to have a relationship with China. But on the U.S. side, it's just like, for example, like Taiwan. It's too difficult, too hard to earn that kind of commitment. So there are a lot of growing frustration, in my understanding, inside of Taiwan. So I'm just giving you a case like this. So I'm just thinking that U.S. Need to look at their economic relationship in all those East Asia Pacific to understand in which country we can actually have more influence. But Taiwan, I don't think it's really that matter because Taiwan needs U.S. Military security support a lot. So in that regard, they overwhelm the economic concern. But in some other places, I think economy is really of importance. So for example, like to Myanmar. U.S. do have a political support of Myanmar recently. But in economic sense, it's China overwhelming present in the Myanmar. And although China's influence now, in my understanding, mostly perceived as negative, but up to the point, I'm not sure how Myanmar general people will view that once that China become really indispensable and they really depends on China. So what I'm saying is that I think U.S. really should look at each of those countries to evaluate what influence they can put in economic aspect and what kind of benefits or costs or bad influences would entail by this kind of economics impact. Thank you. Yeah.
I'd like to thank
all of our panelists for great contributions. I'd like to thank you for your excellent questions. I think we have some really rich data here that has rather profound policy implications, and I think we'll be discussing these issues and how Asians view these issues for some time to come. So we will take a break for 14 minutes and then reassemble here at 11 o'clock, no pressure. But there's coffee and other things out in the corridor down here. So thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you could take your seats, we're going to get started. Andy Nathan is going to moderate the second panel, and I'd like to invite him to the podium.
Thank you, Richard. Everybody sit down. All right. let's get started. So this panel, we have Bridget Welsh, who's been an active member of the Asian Barometer Survey for a long time, and she's a senior research associate center for East Asian Democratic Studies at NTU and has a variety of other affiliations and teaching capacities. And then we're going to have Kai-Ping Huang, who has also been with the Asian Barometer for a long time, is now teaching at National Taiwan University. Then Lu Jie, who's an associate professor at the government department in AU here in DC. They will present in that order, and then we're going to have Constance Steitzenmuller, who's a fellow here at the Brookings Institution, expert on U.S.-Europe relations, and then we will then all come up here and have the discussion. So, Bridget, thank you.
Slides come. Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be back here in Washington, D.C. in Brookings. And we'd like to thank Richard Bush and the Center for East Asian Policy for their kind invitation and sponsoring this, and along with the other sponsors of the program. I always, when Andy is introducing people a long time, as you get older, that takes on special meaning, as I'm sure you know. So one starts to feel one's age. But here we go, as the slides eventually do come. So what today we're looking at a whole range of questions in our survey of the Asian Barometer. And earlier on in the earlier panel, my colleagues focused specifically on the questions that looked at favorability of the U.S. and China, and the narrow range of those questions. We have another question that we're going to focus on today, and then with Kai-Ping and myself, and that looks specifically at a measurement we think is a good proxy, although not the only proxy, for looking at assessments of soft power. We ask in the survey whether or not which country do you think you should follow as a model for development? And what we're doing in the sessions in the next few minutes is to look at the answers of those who said chose the United States and those who chose China, essentially as two different proxy measures for the level of soft power of these two respective countries. And they can choose other countries, and they choose Japan, they choose Singapore, they choose their own country, but we are focusing specifically on the differences and those who chose the U.S. and China, because we think when you choose that as a model, that really indicates that you have a lot of attachment to that specific country, and it's a very, I think, interesting and very useful measure for questions of soft power. Now, here are some of the questions that we're looking at. I need to actually switch because I think what's happened is that they've put my Kai-Ping slides up first. Let me find them. Here we are. Here we go. There we are. So we're looking at levels and measures of soft power, and then we begin to look in the explanation. So what I'm going to look at are the demographic dimensions, and we're going to pick up a little bit on what was mentioned earlier, which is that we see differences in perceptions of age and other factors. But one of the things I'd like to get across a little bit differently compared to my colleagues this morning, and that is I think that we're starting to see when we look at soft power that the U.S. is really failing to engage lots of citizens across East Asia. And there are gaps, and there are shifts and changings that are taking place. And I think this has a lot to do with the way Obama's administration has actually engaged with East Asia. It's been highly elitist, focusing on having visits and trips, as opposed to focusing on engagement with citizens. And we'll look at this and see where there are these gaps in some meaningful ways. All right, so because I think many of us think about the region not just as East Asia, but North and versus Southeast Asia, what we're seeing here are the answers to these questions. And so this particular graph basically distinguishes and identifies the number of percentage in those countries that chose the U.S. and China as a respective model. So we know, as we've learned earlier, Japanese do not choose China. So we see that big sharp divide. But we see, for example, that Koreans do, in very high numbers, choose the United States. Some small shares in respective actually choose China. But where the interesting finding here is on Hong Kong, where, in fact, more people choose China as a model compared to the U.S. It's not a big difference, but it is an important difference. Now, this is the change over time between the last wave, which was carried out between 2010 and 2013, and the most recent wave. And in most of the areas, as indicated earlier, things haven't really shifted. So in Japan, Taiwan, and Mongolia, we've seen modest shifts, but pretty much inconsistent, not that significant. But where the changes are interestingly in Korea and in Hong Kong. So we're seeing that more people are choosing the United States as a model in Korea compared to the previous wave. And actually, in Hong Kong, more people are choosing China. And this is one of the big takeaways you would have, I think, interestingly enough, is that when we look at places like Hong Kong, we're actually seeing China, in terms of its soft power, gaining ground in very interesting sets of ways. And we'll come to the reasons for that, I think, in a little bit later. Now, the second issue is looking at the same questions in the context of Southeast Asia. And so here, this region sees much more variability. This is not a surprise. Right? We would expect to see that variability. And in fact, there are a lot of consistencies with the previous panel, which asked similar sets of questions. We see, for example, in the Philippines, very large numbers choosing the U.S. as a model. One of the things I find so striking about the Philippines is that they never choose their own model. So it's really quite an interesting set of numbers. And interestingly, Cambodia, the gentleman's question earlier. One of our findings across the board about the Cambodia findings is that there is very high support for the United States compared to China, which of course is the opposite of what the government is doing. The government has a very pro-China policy. So there is a disconnect between the government's policy and the policy of the views of the citizens. So we see those different numbers. Also, Vietnam. Look at Vietnam. In terms of only 2% choose China as a model compared to 30% choosing the United States. Again, sharp variations in this context. So we see strong U.S. support is one pattern. Then we see quite even splits. Singapore is a good example of an even split in that type of area. Similar, we see a dynamic that is evolving, and I think we're seeing this trend in places like Malaysia and Thailand, where there is more support for China as a model than the United States. And the earlier conversation by Yun Han was that this has to do with the Muslim societies. I think it's a bit more complicated than that, and I want to get into some of those variables in a little bit. In even split, we also see Indonesia. So this gives you a sense of that. And of course, in Myanmar, there is a much more pro-US position than China as well. So variability in these three patterns. Now, here's the changes over time in the last five years, right? Another important takeaway that we see here is that there is a contraction of support in Indonesia. Indonesia was supposed to be Obama's success story. He lived in Indonesia. And what I think one of the implications of this is that the survey research show that there wasn't effective capitalization. By the way, he wasn't born in Indonesia. Just as a point of clarification. So, but it is an interesting dimension because this, I would say, is one of the lost opportunities of the administration. And I think something that is a wake-up call for the next administration because Indonesia is such an important regional power and global power. Keep in mind, it is part of the G20. All right. We see loss of advantages in Malaysia, Singapore, and Thailand. Here, again, one of the issues to emphasize is that in parts of Southeast Asia, U.S. soft power is contracting. And in many core members of ASEAN, Malaysia, Thailand, and Singapore, this is where it's happening. And this is the battleground for contesting soft power in the region. And it's actually one that the U.S., I believe, is losing. But there are some bright spots, and that has, in the context from the perspective of the U.S., Cambodia and Vietnam, we have very important gains in terms of perceptions of choosing the U.S. as a model, and I think this is a very interesting dynamic, but not as large as the quite a big difference in the context of Vietnam. And, of course, that's been exacerbated by a lot of the security concerns and China's policy on the South China Sea and other areas. So we also asked the question, well, who is it that is actually taking these different perspectives? Why are they taking them? So the first cut on this is to look at demographic factors. So we see generally, as has been supported earlier, younger East Asians are more likely to choose the United States over China as a model. We're also finding that in urban areas and among wealthy populations, they are less likely to choose the United States. This is a very important point, right? That means the U.S., people who choose the U.S. as a model are in the rural areas and poorer. Not exactly the composition from a perspective of the U.S. of who you want to be supporting you as a model. And in fact, the political elite classes are not choosing the U.S., they're choosing China. And ironically, one of the things is that the U.S. policy towards the region has been centered on elites, on political elites, and in fact, they're not winning them to the same degree, especially in those areas that we would actually, among in urban areas or wealthier groups of populations. And we look at this. Here is the graph that looks at the issues of youth. And there are generally, as I said, the trend is that young people, and you can see those things go down in this direction, slightly higher youth, adult, and elderly. But the youth advantage is not huge. And in fact, there are a couple interesting exceptions, which I think I wanted to point out. The first exception is the Philippines. The Philippines has really high levels of support for the U.S. in terms of soft power, but it's not necessarily among young people. And it's interesting to watch the impact of the Duterte presidency, because he won a lot of support among young people. He's using ethnic language, nationalist fervor. It's actually gaining ground, especially among young people. And it will be interesting to see how that translates. So we see, and also in Korea, also we see that older people tend to be much more in the U.S., choosing U.S. as compared to China. So what does this all mean? What are the implications so far of this particular answer? Right? That In the most contested region of soft power, the United States is not winning, as I mentioned earlier, particularly in places like Singapore, Malaysia, and Thailand. And this is the shift and changes over time, that Indonesia's policy has not really translated among in the citizens at large. And I think this speaks to a gap in terms of the engagement with the region. And in fact, the gains are the places where China is. And this implications of this is China is its own worst enemy in the sense that it's actually having backfire effects in places like Cambodia and in places like Vietnam. In Northeast Asia, U.S. position remains much stronger than that of Southeast Asia. And one of the things for someone like myself who works on Southeast Asia foreign policy and issues, what we're seeing in the context of Southeast Asia is that one of the challenges has been the administration continues to, and administrations continue to look at Southeast Asia as a competition with China, not looking at Southeast Asia itself as a region. And this is where the battlegrounds are gaining and also where we're seeing important shifts that are taking place. citizens are not necessarily being engaged adequately. And I think this is an important wake-up call for U.S. policy in the new administration. I'll stop there.
Okay, so good morning. So I'm going to talk about why more East Asians choose China, choose U.S. model over China model. And actually, to analyze this one, this question, actually, I think because U.S. still outperforms China in every aspect, including politically, economically, and culturally. So here, I'm not going to talk about why there are so many people choose the U.S. over China model, but rather where there is narrowing gap between the preference of China and U.S. model. And I think to ask this question is most sensible because what the U.S. policymakers should be concerned with is where those gap is narrowing instead of widening. And so so here we are going to talk about in different regions whether different factors can explain the variation across those regions. And so the first one we want to ask is about whether trade matters. And if we look at Northeast Asia, and so you can see that actually the horizontal line is the trade between the difference in trade between the U.S. and China. Actually, most countries in Asia have more trade volumes with China than with the U.S. And the vertical line is actually the difference between choosing the U.S. and China. So actually, we know that actually more people tend to choose the U.S. over China. And so here we can see that the line, the regression line actually is negative, which means when you trade more with China, you actually will choose less, you will choose the U.S. less. So which means you will have a narrowing gap between the U.S. Between choosing the U.S. and China. But the research is actually more about Hong Kong. And so as we talked about before, actually Hong Kong has very special relationship with China, and it depends a lot on China economically and politically. But if we take out Hong Kong, actually the regression line is positive, which means in Northeast Asia, trade more with China, actually get to wider gap between choosing U.S. and China. So they trade more with China, but they actually tend to choose U.S. more. But how about Southeast Asia? So Minhua has already mentioned that Asia economy, China's economic influence is actually a very important factor in this region. But that's not the case in Northeast Asia, but it is the case in Southeast Asia. So when we look at this graph, actually when people trade, for countries in Southeast Asia, when they trade more with China, they actually the preference between choosing U.S. and China actually gets narrow. But of course, we have two outliers, that is the Philippines and Vietnam. And as we just discussed before, so these two countries have territorial disputes with China, and so that maybe affect how, you know, affect that the Asia tend to choose U.S. more over China. Okay, and so across region, Asia protectionism is widespread, but here in Northeast Asia, we see that you know protectionism doesn't affect much between choosing U.S. and China, except in Hong Kong. I think, and also Japan, but in Southeast Asia, there's not much differences. The big differences only happen in Myanmar and Vietnam and Singapore. And something interesting is, for those who chose China model, actually few of them are actually protectionist, which means actually protectionist Southeast Asians tend not to choose China as a model, and which also means maybe they think that China's economies might pose some kind of challenge or threat to their own economies. Okay, so then we have to ask, then why people in Northeast Asia don't want to choose China as a model? So then we look at another factor, that is whether values matter. And it doesn't matter in Southeast Asia, as we just discussed. Asia trade can explain more accurate about why between the preference between China and the U.S. But so in this case, we can see that actually the line is negative, which means for those countries who possess higher level of democratic values, they actually, you know, the gap between choosing U.S. and China is actually pretty narrow. But I have to point out this line is almost due to the Philippines. So the Philippines have very low level of democratic values, but they have huge gap between choosing the U.S. and China. So if you take out the Philippines, actually you can see the line there. It's a little bit, it's probably just a flat line there. So which means democratic values doesn't explain much about choosing U.S. and China in Southeast Asia. But how about Northeast Asia? It does matter. So the regression line is positive, which means, you know, countries with higher levels of democratic values, they actually tend to choose the U.S. more as a model against China. And we have outlier there, that is Taiwan. But Taiwan, I have to say that actually in Taiwan, a lot of people choose Japan as the first model. So if you count Japan as something similar to the U.S. model, then you actually will see that Taiwan will be closer to the regression line. Okay, so whether support matters, support for democracy matters, it does matter in Northeast Asia. As you can see, the regression line is positive. How about in Southeast Asia? In Southeast Asia, okay, so the line is negative, but it's also, again, due to the Philippines. But Philippines is a special case here. But if we take out the Philippines, the regression line actually is positive, which means for countries who support democracy, they also tend to choose the U.S. model more than choosing China as a model. Okay, so I think Yunhan already covered this. So we know that, you know, positive view is usually high. I mean, positive view toward the U.S. in the region is usually higher than positive view toward China's impact on the region. And so the exception is in Hong Kong. And in Southeast Asia, we can see that actually, you know, from the Philippines, you have very high percentage of positive view toward the U.S., but then toward Cambodia and then Singapore, that's all still okay. But when you go to Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia, then, you know, the percentage actually flip. So you actually have more people who have positive views toward China than toward the U.S. Okay, so at the individual level, we also run some analysis, but I'm not going to delve into these boring numbers. So I will just give you the summary of the findings. Okay, so trade flow matters in Southeast Asia, but not in Northeast Asia. And protectionist views was high across the region, but even protectionist is Asian support the U.S. model. But we also have some exceptions in Myanmar, Singapore, and Vietnam. It's Asians who possess democratic values were more likely to choose the U.S. over China model. It's Asians who possess traditional values were more or less likely to choose the U.S. over China model. Then this is a very interesting finding. But we just mentioned before, wealthier is Asians or urban is Asians. The Asians tend not to choose the U.S. as a model. So maybe this elite engagement failed in those countries. And this one actually says that because we know that wealthy people, urban residents, they tend to hold liberal values. I mean, traditional liberal values. But so here it also indicates maybe policy, policy concerns should shift to other dimensions. So it's Asians who support democracy also support the U.S. model to a greater degree than China. And so, and it's Asians who perceive the U.S. Influencing the region positive. They also tend to choose U.S. model over China. And so, of course, we have some exceptions later, but different patterns in Hong Kong, Malaysia, Thailand, and Indonesia, these are the places where U.S. is losing this, its soft power. So our policy implications are like, you know, U.S. policies should shift away from trade, because I think the advantage of the U.S. is Asian values, especially the promotion of democracy, human rights, and good governance in, to some extent in the region. And this is also the area that the U.S. policymakers should consider besides elite engagement, maybe there should be more non-elite engagement in the region, especially in Southeast Asia. And so U.S. soft power cannot be taken for granted, and because it's shifting. So underlying factors accounting for views not being addressed adequately. So it should be addressed adequately in policy. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the invitation. So the first panel and the two panelists of this panel generally talk about the choice between U.S. model and China model, especially among Asian people. Now, my side job is to talk about the lieu of U.S. model among Chinese citizens. This actually for me is a very important and interesting topic. First of all, if we're talking about a competition between U.S. model and China model as a sort of competition of soft power, one major concern would be, how do Chinese people view that, right? I mean, this is sort of like the big, sort of most important battleground, not for U.S., but also for the CCP regime, as to say, how they can attract people to different camps or different ideas of governance. The second issue has some sort of historical longitudinal implication. I believe some of you still remember the Statue of Liberty raised in the Tiananmen Square in 1989 as a symbol that proposed by students as an idea goal for their strive for democracy. Then after so many years, people are still concerned about Chinese people's general views of democracy as a potential model for their future development. And this not has implications for the competition regarding soft power, but always huge implications for the so-called prospect for democracy in China. So this is what I'm going to address using ABS model collected from mainland China. This will be the major sort of outline of today's presentation. We're going to talk a little bit of a debate on the China model versus the US model, especially within the domestic politics context within China. Now I'm going to show you some of the public opinion data and the models that the Chinese people prefer for the future development of mainland China. Then we're going to say, what makes the US model really appealing to the Chinese people? I know many of you have concerns because we talk about the China model, U.S. model, sort of monolithic concept. This is kind of black box. We never unpack that. But in practice, it's actually very difficult for you to ask people why you like the U.S. model. I mean, the only thing we can do is try to infer why people like this model based on some sort of correlation analysis. For instance, if you think they prefer the U.S. model because of rule of law, then your expectation will be those people who think the rule of law in China is really bad and would like to choose the U.S. model. So use that kind of correlation analysis, try to work like a forensic anthropologist, right? You have a skeleton, then you need to figure out what's the underlying story. So this is what do we do with the public opinion data by correlation analysis. So then we use this kind of data to generate some conclusions, implications for public policy. So that's first to see a few words about so-called U.S. versus China model. It's primarily building on a political discourse within China to see U.S. model that primarily been presented liberal democracy with all these key features which you are familiar with. This is a market economy, and also the key proponents within China will be the right-wing intellectuals as a so-called road-leading party in Chinese, called them Dai Lu Dang, which means lead China to the U.S. model, right? Well, on the China side, we see this general presented so-called socialism with Chinese characteristics, intentionally using some of the sort of terms used by the CCP to see, it's a regime characterized by the dominance of CCP with so-called multi-party cooperation and consultation. But some people call these parties pseudo-parties. There are kinds of debates there. It's rule by law instead of rule of law. And this is actually a key component emphasized by the current administration. It's in the literature, it's been characterized as a one-party regime. And when it comes to the economy side, we see this is a market economy, but with significant intervention and regulation from the state. And this is a little bit different from the American model with a key role played by the government. There are also proponents for this kind of China model for the future development, primarily the left-wing intellectuals, and also we have those people who enjoy this kind of discussion, call them 50-cent party, Wu Maodang, or even Zigang. Those people won't receive 50 cent from the party, but volunteer to do this kind of job for the promotion. So this is a general setting of so-called debate of the U.S. versus China model within China, right? Then what kind of response is from people? So we have two waves of surveys that in mainland China talking about which country you think should be the model for our future development. There are a little bit sort of difference in terms of wording. I'll talk about this, but let's show the data first. So clearly we'll see around 25% of Chinese people, this is a national probability sample, choose U.S. as the model for their future development. And this percentage has been quite consistent and stable across years. So one wave died in 2015, one wave 2011, 4 years in between. This is quite consistent. And over the years, you see Singapore appears to be a more attractive model for China's future development. The percentage increased from around 15% to 18% in 2015. What is most interesting is about our own model. See here. Well, in 2011, close to 17% of respondents choose our own model should be followed for our future development. Well, in 2015, it's around 3 or 4%. People say, what's the big difference? There's a big difference in terms of the answer category provided for them. In 2011, our own model was intentionally presented as a category for them to choose. Well, in 2015, that category was not read to the respondents. But if they choose, we should follow our model, where we call it, we should follow our model. Which means in 2011, our own model theoretically is the politically correct answer, right, that you should take. And so many people choose our own model. But if you drop that category, say, we just code our own model. If you volunteer, say, we should follow our model, there's a big difference, a significant change. But a more interesting finding here is, regardless whether you present China as a choice for the people, that doesn't affect their choice over the United States. Right? So you have two different answer categories between 2011 and 2015. But the choice of the United States as a future model for development is relatively really stable and consistent around 26, 25%. And what's more interesting here, I mean, for the first panel, many people talk, why we should ask people, why shouldn't we ask people about different dimensions, influence? There's a huge percentage giving you DK. They have no idea. They don't know. This is not unique for this question. When you check many people's responses to questions, tapping their, for instance, international knowledge, tapping their attitudes, foreign affairs, generally you see a high percentage of DKs. Because remember, this is a national representative sample, right? As we said, we cover all people from China, from both urban areas, rural areas, people with different sort of exposure to the news and information. So given this pattern, how to explain that? Why we have very persistent, robust, close to 26, 27% of people choose US as their model? There are some sort of theoretical conjectures, right? We can take to see why they choose American model. There's kind of argument on say they choose the US model based on rational reflections of the disadvantages and advantages of different types of models. This kind of rational argument assumes, first, people have sufficient information to both models, right? You have enough information to make valid assessments of the different models, then you can choose which one is better for China. And also, there are some key issue domains that we suppose these people should focus on, because these key issue domains are the key differences between the China model versus the US model. For instance, we're talking about rule of law, checks and balances electropolitics, if we focus on political domain, if we focus on economic domain, will be economic prosperity, including institutionalized protection, progress, things like that. And a general expectation will be, if you follow this kind of rational argument, those people who have more negative views of China on all these aspects we mentioned should theoretically be expected to take the US model more likely, right? So if it's purely based on rational elections. The second is, it's not based on fully rationalized reflections and calculations, but more like sort of idealize the goal for our future development, but with very limited specific reflections. So US model folks like something that's ideal that we want to achieve, but for those people, they have some sort of knowledge about the US, but not sufficient knowledge for very comprehensive rational evaluations, and they do not pay specific attention to those specific issue domains that we talked about. So their evaluation of the US model is not about US performance in rule of law, constitutional rule, democracy, protection, human rights, liberty, but more about US is something good. This is called idealized goal with limited specifications. Another approach is simply, it's not a concern, it's just a random response from people who say, I just pick US model. This could be another plausibility to explain people's choice of US model. And with this, you would expect those people with very limited information about the US model, because they have no idea, right, what the US model should be. And also, there should be no specific correlates with their choice of the US model. So these will be some sort of expectations based on how you model people's cognitive process of choosing the US model when confronted with that outcome choice between US and China. Then let's see some sort of empirical evidence to see which one or which approach, which model may be more plausible. So this is the first thing on the frequency of Chinese people following international foreign affairs. This is the first indicator we use to try to capture people's exposure to related information for rational assessments. Where you see across time, it's close to 40 to 50% of people, they follow international news and foreign affairs quite often all the time. You would argue that this will be the relevant percentage of Chinese people with enough information to make comprehensive and rational assessments, right? Which means another half of the people actually don't have that kind of information to make assessment about the US model. There's another thing about, we in this question ask people to assess the democratic quality in different country societies, asking their assessment of Taiwan, India, Japan, United States, and China. These are the percentages of missings when we ask them for their assessment of democratic quality in these specific countries. Whereas when asked to assess democratic quality in China, the missings 20%, which is not huge. But when you push Chinese people to see how democratic do you think the US is, missing percentage is close to 55%. The missing in this question is, again, many people do not have enough information to make valid assessments. Hopefully, I have convinced you that when it comes to the access-related information for comparison assessment, we do not have enough evidence to support that kind of fully rational sort of rationalization-based argument. To say that our choice between China-US model is based on comprehensive assessments of these two models' performance on key aspects and which one should be better for China's future. So this is the first sort of information foundation to make that kind of argument. Now, this is the missing values when they assess American democracy by their choice of model. For those who choose US model, there are around 30% do not know the quality of democracy in US. When they choose all these models, close to 50% do not know about the quality of US. When they choose other models, close to 50% do not know about US quality. So comparatively speaking, for those people who choose US models, they know more about the quality of democracy in US. But again, the percentage of missing is still missing. So for those choose US model, close to 30% of people have no idea of the quality of democracy in the United States, right? So this has some implications for, say, how people choose these models. Now, when it comes to specific reflections, we check these dimensions. For instance, how people perceive the economic performance in China in both national terms and family terms. Over the years,
and in the future, and the concurrent. So these are current, retrospective, prospective evaluations. For the political performance, we choose people's assessments of rule of law in China, the checks and balances politics in China, more here about sort of National People's Congress of supervising the administrative power, and we also check their assessments of Chinese government's responsiveness, as well as the effective of Chinese elections in making people accountable. So theoretically, if you think people's choice of American model is based on full rational assessments of the US model, all these negative assessments should be highly correlated with their choice of the American model, right? They don't like situation in China. They believe the US model should be better. That's why they choose US model. But when we do this very comprehensive statistical modeling, the modeling could be more complicated because we have huge missing values. So we'll run this kind of selection model, which is not something that you will be interested in, right? But I just give you the results. If you believe me, I've been crunching data for many years, and the result is they all fail. So no matter which aspect you focus on, people's assessments of these key dimensions are statistically insignificant relationship with their choice of American model. Which means, again, we do not have sufficient evidence say these people choose US model based on comprehensive rational evaluations assessments of two models. Now it comes to what really matters, right? So when it comes to the democratic assessments, we ask people to choose, assess democratic quality in US, democratic quality in China. Then can compare which one for them is more democratic. Again, the missing values are significant across years, 50%. Close to 25 to 30% believe US is more democratic than China, if you think this will be rational people, right? Well, around 5 to 8% of people believe China-US equally democratic. Well, close to 15% of respondents believe actually China is more democratic than the US. Now, we can take this as some sort of indicator. If you believe US is more democratic than China, then you should prefer US model if you really emphasize the perfects of democracy in China, right? If you believe China is more democratic than the US, then why do you care about the US model? This will be, so we take a difference between their evaluations, US quality, democracy and Chinese democracy. The difference ranges between negative to positive. Well, negative stands for they think China is more democratic, while the positive values, they think US is more democratic. So you find those people who believe US is more democratic actually more like to choose the US model. And those people who find China is more democratic are more like to see we should follow our own model for democratic choices. So this is one general feeling about democracy in China may have some relationship with our choice of the US model. This is one indicator we find statistically significant in our all rounds of regressions. The other general feeling is about life satisfaction. We have a 10-point scale to measure life satisfaction with 1 as the lowest satisfaction, with 10 as highest satisfaction. We'll see those people who are more satisfied with their life in China, actually they are less likely to choose US as their model for future development. And those people who are more satisfied with their life in China, more likely to choose our own model for future development. That also has some implications, but again, this measure is a very general measure about people's feelings, right? It's not about specific aspects or dimensions of China's performance. So have two general feeling measures that matters. First is about situation of democracy in China. Second is about your life satisfaction in China. There are some sort of information access also matters. This captures people's news consumption in China, primarily domestic news media. What you will find is, for those people who consume news more, actually they are less likely to take the US model as a choice. This has some implications, for instance, for propaganda, right? For indoctrination, for how Chinese people manipulate this kind of information flow to shape people's understandings. What is very interesting about this information access is, people with more consumption of domestic media actually more like to choose Singapore. This is also compatible with the public discourse, right? But Singapore is presented as one-party government with high transparency, low corruption, right? High efficiency. So this is something they really want. And it seems that the propaganda or the information manipulation has worked to some extent. So this is one measure that matters. Another one is something which is not surprising given previous presentations. After controlling for their life satisfaction, assessment democracy, information pressure, young people still on average more like choose US model for their future development. So we have taken away life satisfaction, assessment democracy, information access, excluding the influence of these factors, still found young people on average more likely to choose US model as the first choice. So this has some implications for the so-called generation shift, with implications for values, maybe norms, their views of the world, things like that. But how to unpack that? We need more data, right, to do the further analysis. Another interesting factor we have is about education. So generally, you would argue, if you still remember the image of Statue of Liberty raised in Tiananmen Square in 1989, you would highly educated people more likely prefer U.S. as a model for future development. Actually, after accounting for all the other factors, you find U.S. model is more attractive among those people with primary education with lesser primary education as compared to those people with higher education. For people with higher education in China, Singapore model or our own model actually more attractive. So what does it mean? High education means higher sophistication for political decision making. But it also means more experience in the education system in China, which means more exposure to potential political ideological campaigns education. So how that captures underlying dynamics is not interesting that we need to engage. Just do not take it for granted that college students are more likely to favor the US over China. This is not the case, according to the data. Then the preliminary conclusions. Again, there are many things we could do with the data, but this is based on very preliminary analysis of data. Say, in China, we found a sort of moderate preference for the US model. Remember, consistently 25-26%. But this is against the percentage close to 50 with missings, right? People don't know. They have no idea which model should be chosen. And all the data suggests there are very limited role of rational reflections of China's own problems. When it comes to choice of US model, they're not correlated with people's perceptions of all key major economic political aspects of the Chinese government, but primarily related to what? General views of the USA, PRC, democratic disparity, general feelings of life satisfaction. What a potential interpretation of those people who are not satisfied with their life in China, right? They want to take alternative model, and that model should be sufficiently different from China. And which one is sufficiently different from China? I mean, US could be choice. That is not based on, again, very comprehensive rational assessments of these two models, advantages and disadvantages. Again, we see there's a significant lack of related information for people to make assessments and rationalize their choice. So among those people with sufficient information, you can find an intriguing role played by education, right? Education increases people's capability for making decisions, increase their cognitive sophistication, but also in China's context, more opportunities for propaganda and ideological campaigns. So how to tease out this kind of very nuanced dynamics within education is not an interesting thing. And they have very limited rational reflections of the US model, and maybe we should talk more about the potential role played by the Chinese government in promoting the so-called China model among the Chinese people. So thank you so much.
Good morning, everyone. Can we turn this off? Thank you. Good morning. My name is Constanze Stelzenmüller. I'm a fellow at Brookings in the Center on the US and Europe, and I am, to those of you who don't know my biography and those who do, very obviously the outlier in this workshop, because I'm not a specialist on China, East Asia, or their relations with the United States. I'm a specialist on my own country, Germany, on Europe and transatlantic relations. I am, however, a human rights and international law. That's my background. And I used to be a journalist, and I worked for Die Zeit, which may be familiar to some of you, as a paper once published by Helmut Schmidt, who, as some of you may know, was very good friends with Lee Kuan Yew, and therefore had very strong views on things like Asian values and collective rights and responsibilities. And
that led to, among other things, my newspaper once publishing a Singaporean government initiative called the Declaration on Human Responsibilities. I don't know whether any of you have ever heard of that. That was an attempt to circumscribe the reach and impact of the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights. It's the only government initiative I have ever actually, as a journalist, actively tried to sabotage. And I won't bore you with that, but that I do take a strong interest in questions of our relationship with East Asia and efforts to achieve democratic transformation and liberal governance there. The other reason why I'm standing up here, I think, is that I once used to run a survey and presented it for many years. That was the German Marshall Fund's Transatlantic Trends, which began life as a European-American survey. We tried very hard, including in my time, to expand it to Asia. But as has been mentioned here several times, including by Bruce Stokes, with whom we worked closely many times, that proved incredibly difficult to do. For one, because the information spaces are so different, because the cultural translation necessary to do this kind of thing, to ask the same kinds of questions in these very different political spaces, is an enormous and very complex undertaking. And also very simply because of the quite extraordinary costs of surveying in Asia. To those of you who've ever tried to do this, you will know what I'm talking about. But I remember that I think we were told that asking 3 to 5 questions in Japan would cost us $100,000. In other words, if you're trying to do something serious, a survey with 20, 30, 40 questions, which is what we were doing with Transatlantic Trends, and in at least 5 countries, you really basically have to set up a meth lab somewhere to be able to finance this kind of undertaking. Anyway, I found this morning's presentations fascinating because I think that they show that there is a great deal of disconnect, not just in our understanding of each other's political spaces, but also between our understanding of what polls can tell us and our government policies, dare I say. The reason that I'm not going to comment on the questions, on the findings or their interpretation, since I've only just heard them this morning, and I think that I would need to look at them more carefully to be able to do that with any credibility. I do want to point out to you, if I may, how this relates to the kind of work that I do and that we do in the Center on the U.S. and Europe. And the first point I want to make is to emphasize just how important doing polls is in the current atmosphere. I think that cannot be overemphasized. We find ourselves, at least in Europe and in the transatlantic space, and I think from what I've seen this morning, this is equally true for the Asian space, in a situation of what has been called post-factual politics, where the public debate space, the agora of public opinion, is overwhelmed by facts, pseudo-facts, distortions and outright lies, produced by social media, but also by government propaganda and outright government interference. You only have to read today's New York Times story about Russian propaganda in Europe to know what I'm talking about. If you haven't read it, I recommend it to you. And the result of that is that we are seeing in Europe a governments on the defensive against populist movements everywhere, fueled by this kind of overwhelmed public debate space. We are seeing this on the American side as well, of course. You will have followed the debate on Monday night. And I think that this emphasizes the need for polls as a tool to understand social attitudes and political preferences, attitudes about each other in a global space that is becoming more and more integrated, where we are mobile as persons, where data are mobile, where assets are mobile, capital is mobile, but we understand less and less about each other, and there is more and more potential for friction. Yeah. So that's my first point. I think that if I had one major policy prescription, it would be that governments and civil society, represented by media or foundations, ought to invest more in polls and into their interpretation. I think that is worth all the money we can throw at it, frankly, because I think that this would help sort through some of the confusion. Already, much of what I've seen this morning, I think, would be helpful in elucidating a great deal of the questions that we have about each other. My second sort of very large and general point is about the policy implications of this. In the world that I'm, the academic field that I work in, which is tries to formulate potential strategies for Europe and America to work with each other in a world that is shaped by globalization and interdependence, polls are important for providing the connection between representative governance and its policymakers and those who are represented. Again, one of the key phenomena that we're seeing right now is a disconnect of understanding and communication between representative democracy and its electorate. That is, you find elites policymaking, analytical, political, on the defensive against this on both sides of the Atlantic. And I presume similar things are true of East Asia as well. Because social media give the electorate so much more power to shape the debate space than they've ever had, that is now more important than ever. And if we want to preserve representative democracy against the identitarian temptation and against illiberal temptations, it seems to me that that puts a premium on understanding what people want and what they think. My final point is about the triangular relationship between America, Europe, and East Asia and all this. Europe hasn't been mentioned at all today, but of course Europe and its constituent nations are players, and in some cases key players in this space. And of course we occasionally collaborate with America, and occasionally we are in competition with it. There is a great deal of acknowledged and unacknowledged friction, and it in the end, the ultimate endeavor that I think we should all be pursuing is to prevent that friction from spilling over into actual conflict or all-out war, which today in some ways seems more possible than it has been for a very long time. And the best way I've heard the challenge formulated is oddly in a paper by two American officers who were staffers for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs a couple of years back, who described the European, American, Asian triangle as a strategic ecosystem. And I think that metaphor is useful for us to consider the implications of our actions and inactions in this field and our ability to understand each other, because what it means is that an ecosystem is, I think, by definition, something that is fragile, that needs to be very carefully managed, where balance is a precious good, and is something that needs to be worked on. And again, I'm going to come back to my very general point. The beginning and the end all of that is understanding each other, and that is where polls can play a huge role. Thank you very much. I'll stop here.
Well, thank you. Those were great presentations. We have about 20 minutes. Let me make a couple comments. I'm not a commentator, but one of the longstanding themes of the Asian Barometer surveys has been that respondents have different understandings of what democracy is. We know that, and we've asked about that in every wave of the survey. We also asked them, I believe, I forget who presented this particular data, but the democracy gap between China and the U.S. as it is assessed by the respondent. We just say, how democratic do you think this country is? But we know that people are assessing this gap on different criteria. So the first book that the Asian Barometer Survey published, How East Asians View Democracy, and later investigations as well, are exploring these different concepts of democracy. When Lucia, and so now in this panel, we're not so much using the word democracy, we're using the word model, I guess. What was the question in the questionnaire?
Which country would you choose as a model?
As a model. And here it has the same ambiguity as any, as we discussed in the first panel. You know, when they speak of the model, what do they mean by that? The political model, the lifestyle model, the economic model, and so forth. And I think we didn't dig into that. But Lujia has an idea that we can assess what kind of model does the individual have in mind by looking at some of the correlates, right, of that preference. And I think that's a very promising way to go. But you mentioned economic and political attributes. But a person might have, I liked the comment in the morning panel from somebody over here that by soft power, he thinks it basically means where do you want to send your kid or where do you want to go live. That's not so much caught by your two things of economic, and it might be environment, breathing the air. It might be the educational system, science and technology. So I think that Lujia's approach is promising, but it's going to need more work to tease out the idea of the model. And then I thought, when he said that most of the people, they just don't know. And I said to Richard, I said, that's the good news. They're choosing the United States because they don't know anything about the United States. On the other hand, perhaps from a policy point of view, we don't care so much about those people anyway. And so we want to dig into the ones who more who do know and see what they're choosing the United States for the, what reason and so forth. And that might bring us to the slide that Kai-Ping didn't show us, the regression model that you passed over very quickly would be interesting to look at. So those are just some quick comments. Okay, questions. Richard.
I'd like to address Bridget's discussion of Hong Kong, which I found interesting but puzzling. First of all, it's my recollection that the level of democratic values in a previous Asian Barometer survey was higher than what you showed. And so I don't recollect it for sure, but something's going on there. Second, and more substantively, I think that recent events suggest that the desire or for something like the U.S. model may be stronger than was revealed in the survey. The district council elections last year and the recent legislative council elections this year, I think, were a repudiation of China's approach to democratization in Hong Kong. And a vote of support for the democratic movement there. Second, I think other polling has shown that the desire for democratic institutions has been very strong for a long time, and I suspect remains strong. If I can make a guess, I would say that perhaps the timing of this particular survey may explain the results that you got. And I just checked with Yunhan, the timing was early this year. And if one looks at the United States early this year, that's not a model I would want to adopt either.
Can I answer?
Oh, of course, yeah.
I'd like to pick up a little bit of what Bruce said earlier this morning at Pew, and that is, I think timing only affects a marginal perspective. So I think that I would not put as much emphasis on timing as you do, Richard. And we were not presenting democratic values. We were presenting choice of model. In the sense, the democratic values would be quite high, as you indicated. That's another part of the survey. But
that was used in one of your
And we were looking at a correlation, but we never presented the actual amounts that the Hong Kong people feel about democratic values. But we could provide that for you. But I would say that I do think there is something very important here in Hong Kong, and that is that more Hong Kongers are choosing China as a model over the last 5 years than the U.S., despite what's happening. All right, and the question asks, you have to ask, why is that? And it may not, as Kai-Ping was suggesting, it's not related to democratic values. That's, in fact, not as a factor as it is in other parts of this Northeast Asia. But I think it also could be related to U.S. policy towards Hong Kong. And in the sense of whether or not they are supporting aspects of democratic values or how they're engaging with Hong Kong. And I think that raises other sets of questions.
I'm Elliot Hurwitz, a former intelligence community person and the World Bank staff contractor. One of the panelists, thank you very much for a wonderful panel. I really appreciate your information. One of the panelists stated that a country with a higher level of democratic values, countries with a higher level of democratic values, do not have more people choosing the United States. And as far as I heard, there may be a contradiction in that presentation compared with other things that were said. So I would appreciate anyone's comments on that. Thank you very much.
Okay, so is your democratic values do matter in Northeast Asia, but not so much in Southeast Asia? So in Southeast Asia, we see that choosing China and the U.S. actually is determined mostly by trade values. But in Northeast Asia, you will see that when you trade more with China, you actually tend to choose U.S. more as the model. So in this case, actually, in Northeast Asia, we see the trend that countries with higher level of democratic values, they actually tend to choose the U.S. So which means trade values cannot explain why they choose the U.S. more, but democratic values do.
Hello, I am Yan Qi Huang, a visiting fellow in CSIS. And my question is about the definition. Yeah, it's pretty general. Yeah, as we all know, China has been considered as a developing country. And in the near future, I think it will still be a developing country. So what China model really means for people who live in a advanced country like Japan, and what does this factor mean in your study? I mean, for the three panelists on my left. Sorry.
I think it is important to unpack why Japanese or other advanced countries might choose China. It's interesting. Japan doesn't choose China, but Singaporeans do. And they have very high level of economic development. So I think that while I agree with you that economic development might be a factor, I think that there are different people are choosing China for different sets of reasons. And one of the challenges of survey research is we're not able to fully unpack what those reasons are. Some of it may be democratic values or the lack thereof. Some of it may be the sense that they are the regional power and they want to be with the regional power. Some of it may be about economic relationships and economic opportunities. And I think one of the steps that's necessary to complement polls, which I think are important, is to also do focus groups and other sets of analysis to interpret how some of these things are there. So we are cautious not to overinterpret that. But from what I can tell you from what we see in the data, that being the status of a development doesn't necessarily affect how they view China. It's a combination of factors. That's what we see.
I'd just like to add something. The one point that you didn't mention is something that people also want, I think, generally, is stability. And improvement of their general perspective in life. And there are ways in which democracy is associated with more stability, and in some cases people associated with less stability. And I think one of the things that would be worth unpicking in future waves is just what
what the term means for people, what they associate with it, and what they perhaps fear from it. That in fact is a prerequisite for any kind of thoughtful, coordinated Western policy response.
I think what my colleague Kai-Ping has shown about the relationship between the level of democratic attitude and value, and whether that relate to people might, you know, with higher democratic value might choose American as a model more. I think the macro picture, you know, for ASEAN country, it's not very clear cut, right? No, it's like flat. But I think if you dig further down to individual level analysis, I think in a lot of country, including ASEAN country, people who subscribe more to democratic value, the higher probability that they also choose the United States as a model. But it's not shown at the macro level, but it has been shown at individual level. So I just want to add that footnote, yeah.
Hi, my name is Alexandra Frick with the Stern Group. I have a question for Dr. Huang specifically on Trump's trade policy on China. He has spoken that if he will be elected, he wants to have much more harsh measures. And I think that this will only really increase trade tension and really damage trade relations. I was curious what your opinion on would be on if this would have a ripple effect throughout East Asia. I know you said during your presentation that trade has little impact on creating soft power, but I wanted to know what the opposite would be, if it would, if Trump's policy would really damage the soft power that we do have.
Yes. We'll never get a visa here again, I'll tell you that.
Okay. Who wins.
Okay, so trade does matter in Southeast Asia, as we show you, and so but we also show you that, you know, protectionist actually can also affect whether people tend to choose the U.S. model or China model, and so I think at least right now in East and Southeast Asia, people tend to think that at least like the U.S. is a benign trading partner, not like China, because China in some way has to compete with other countries in Southeast Asia in terms of investment or something like that. And so we can see that, you know, for countries who think that, you know, China's economic power might be perceived as trade, they actually tend not to choose the China model. So if Trump, should I get into that? If Trump wins, and if he's really tough on that, and so I think that might be have some effect, I mean, impact on whether people would like to choose the U.S. as model as well.
We have some questions in the survey that we call ideology about, do you favor that the state is more involved in the economy, or do we have a protectionism question? We do, right? Do you think, but this is a question about in our country, like in Malaysia and Indonesia, should we have free trade or less, more? That question we're asking. We're not asking any question about, in our survey, about should the U.S. have more protectionism, but none of these reports really exploited that battery about people's ideology.
I think, you know, while one of the challenges is that we found that the U.S. focus on the TPP, which has been the predominant focus in the context of East Asia, especially Southeast Asia, some of the Southeast Asian countries, it's not really translated into soft power. But one has to understand, as I'm sure you do, that the relationship of trade is connected to questions of security, questions of stability, questions associated with perceptions of power dynamics that are shifting. I think if trade policy shifts significantly vis-a-vis Asia, and it's not just China, vis-a-vis Asia, it's going to have a ripple effect on all of the other factors, be it stability, and also it's going to have a ripple effect on perceptions of competition between China and the U.S. in the region itself. So I think one cannot isolate one element to see what the implications are. I think it would be premature for us to say what those views would be in the future because we don't know. But I think what the survey data has shown us in the past is that these things are interrelated and that they're connected. And I think that one can definitely say that they will have an impact, probably in ways that are greater than what we expect.
Thanks. My name's Yu Hao. I'm a master's student at Georgetown University. This question occurred to me during Lu Jue's presentation, but it's definitely related to other panelists as well. And the question is, you mentioned when you do the survey asking people why is China a model to them, you mentioned a rule by law and regulated by and a regulated market. I think those two are maybe more negative aspects of Chinese government rather than positive. I just wonder, how will you tease out the sort of benevolent or positive factors of Chinese government as compared to the benefits of a democratic system? One example I can think of is Chinese people, they do think their government, although it's not as democratic as the American government, there is a huge level of trust for Chinese people towards their government, and there's also accountability in China's politics, although in the absence of a very functioning democracy. So I wonder how it tease out the factors of a Chinese model.
So first, there's a clarification. I'm not saying that rule by law is a positive aspect of Chinese model. It's just in the political discourse, public discourse, these are the key features people emphasize when they talk about the China model. And to identify whether people identify China model because of rule by law, and the key thing is you ask their assessments of the practice of rule by law in a situation to see how they correlate, which is basic logic we use here. But we do not check the practice of rule by law, but we do check people's assessment of practice of rule of law in China to see how that correlates with their choice of the U.S. model, right? So if you ask U.S. model is attractive because of rule of law, then those people with more negative assessments of rule of law in China should be more likely to choose a U.S. model. So that's the very straightforward logic to argue. But if you find the data, they are not correlated. So again, the information presented here is in many cases, their choice or preference over the U.S. model is not based on comprehensive rational assessments of different aspects of models, but more like ideologues. Sort of, it's related to other audience question about why people choose different models. I mean, the pre-assumption we attach to that, first you need to have some sort of unsatisfaction with the working of the model in your country, right? If you're fully satisfied with how the government performs, and we just go our own way. Then the next question is, if you are not satisfied with how the government works here, what could be attractive to you for an alternative model, right? So that's why we focus on people's very negative sentiment toward varying aspects of Chinese government's performance to see which one could be potentially correlated with our choice of U.S. model. Then you infer that could be potential rationale for that choice. As I said, everything is based on this kind of circumstantial evidence. You cannot directly ask people why you like U.S. model. As I said, many people don't know about the U.S. model. But the trust thing, I think, you must have, since you're from George Washington, Bruce Dickinson has written a book on that, right? It's all kinds of discussions about political trust in China, so he may have more say on that regard.
Yeah. Last question.
Question is primarily for Bridget. You concluded, I think, that you said U.S. soft power, particularly in Southeast Asia, is contracting and that this is a wake-up call. My question, I guess, is what is the remedy for that? You made a reference to lack of engagement at the citizens' level, but if you could just elaborate on how we address that problem.
I think there are essentially three areas. First of all, U.S. policy in engagement with Southeast Asia has been very much at the elite level. as in we're having a number of people who are visiting just along at leaders. There's been only a youth program, but that has actually been very ad hoc and not consistently across the board. And so the perception is that the U.S. government is allied with leaders. I mean, Najib and Obama play golf together, while Kelantan is flooding, and the parts of the states of Malaysia are underwater. And, the perception is that Obama and Najib are friends. And this type of perception has a resonance in the context of Southeast Asia. The same thing, Clinton and others come to visit Indonesia, and their level of engagement, even in town hall meetings, is actually very minimalist. And most of the visits are very much at the elite level. And I think this is actually a problem, in that there has been a contraction in U.S. governance and U.S. policy towards areas such as VOA, libraries, other aspects of terms of engaging citizens. The public forums are actually contracting. And it's contracting even worse when we have huge numbers and resources put into Confucius centers. So the relative difference is there. The second issue that I think is actually important is that I think the problem that many Southeast Asians feel is that they are in the competition with China, so that its U.S. policy towards Southeast Asia is about China. It's not about Southeast Asia. And I think that, and it's about the competition of trying to out China, in the context of the region. And so Southeast Asians don't feel engaged as Southeast Asians. They feel that they're caught up in a battle, and that's whether or not that's in the context of the fight over the South China Sea, whether or not it's contestation between Malaysia and China, China and the U.S. over Malaysia policy, the same thing in the context of Thailand. So the second thing is to begin to look at Southeast Asia as something uniquely separate. And importantly is to pick up on something Yunhan mentioned earlier, to not see this as a zero-sum game, to see this as something that is actually, there can be two sets of expanding dimensions. It's not us versus them in this particular context. And I think the third factor, and this is that democratic values have really, with the exception of Myanmar, just evaporated from the perspective of U.S. policy towards Southeast Asia. The perception is that they ally with the dictators, as opposed, and they have left human rights behind. And I said Myanmar is the exception, but it's not the case. There's been very little criticism of the coup in Thailand. Najib and Obama are best friends, and even if he is a kleptocrat in terms of corruption issues, and it's not the Obama administration that's dealing, it's the Justice Department, and they see this as very different. So I think that the traditional allies that you have in Southeast Asia, the people who are more democratic, more open, wanting trade liberalization, are actually the ones you're losing the most in Southeast Asia.
Well, thank you to the panelists and to the audience for your questions, and Richard will give us a benediction.
Thank you very much, Andy. Thank you for chairing. As I said before, I think we've had a very rich discussion, and as the last comment clearly suggested, raised some sort of fairly profound issues about U.S. policy, and so it's a good programmatic agenda for whoever takes over our complicated democratic system. So thank you all for coming, and thanks to everybody in Yunhan's group. Thank you, Yunhan.